Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the March 6, 2017 commission meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District. This morning's session is a study session, and this afternoon we'll be meeting in a business session. It's great to see a good number of public here to take in our meeting today, and I'm guessing that there'll probably be some public testimony a little bit later in the agenda, and we really appreciate that public testimony. We ask for anybody that's wanting to give public testimony that you come up to the microphone here at the table, state your name and address for the record since our meetings are recorded. And if it appears that we're going to have a large number of people participating, I would ask you that direct your comments to the commission and try to be as concise as possible because who knows how many people we want who want to make comments today. Also like to note that four of our five commissioners are here. Commissioner Bowles is excused and all the regular staff are here. And also at this time would like to ask people to silence their cell phones if you would, and would appreciate that. That aids in the conduct of business. And the first item on our agenda today is the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute. Normally we have a one staff person do that, but today we get a twofer. We're going to have Scott Erickson lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance and Lisa Graves give the Safety Minute. But I just need to note that we wanted to have Scott fulfill this duty as one of his last duties as a PUD employee. Scott is retiring, and I believe this is the last time he'll be with us when we have a commission meeting. So if you'll all stand, and Scott, if you would.
Please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. You bet. Thank you, Scott, for a lot of years.
And a lot of smiles. I've never seen Scott not smiling. It's amazing. I know.
Oh, a lot easier. Oh, all right. Well, I have props. I
hope that that won't work. You want to sit down and use your props?
I'm kidding. I'm all right. Okay. So I'm Lisa Graves. I'm a real estate specialist. My safety minute is on hearing protection. I think all of us are aware that when we're working with power tools or working for a sustained period of time in a loud environment, that we should use hearing protection. So we know that. That's probably thanks to all the great work the district safety department has put into teaching us. But I'm here to make hearing protection fun. One of the things that you may not know is that there are apps out there that will tell you what the volume is of the area that you're in.
Really?
So, free, just download it to your phone, turn it on, impress your friends.
Decibels? Does that say in decibels?
Decibels.
It does. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to pass it on or she just gave me a phone.
go ahead. Whistle. Do something. So, it's just kind of fun to know what it is if you're in an environment and you just got to wonder. Anything over 85 decibels over a sustained period of time can cause hearing
really?
Loss. Yep.
Ooh, my voice was 75.
So the other reason hearing protection's been on my mind lately is in a couple of weeks, I'm going to go see the Red Hot Chili Peppers. So so I thought to myself, well, I'm going to have to dig out my earplugs for concerts. So we've all seen those little foam jobbies that you roll up and you stick in your ears. They don't work real well for me. I can never get them in right. My husband says if I look like Frankenstein, I'm not using them right. So I usually end up asking him to help me put them in. There are earplugs out there, relatively inexpensive, $13 to $20, that diminish the volume across the sound spectrum. So if you're at a concert and you want to hear the music, which is why you're there, you aren't going to lose parts of the music. That's a good thing. And those are, like I said, really inexpensive. There are other options, custom molded earplugs that if you're really serious about your music or you have other reasons to protect your hearing, maybe you go shooting or something like that. They're custom molded. I'm not going to pass those ones around. They're my husband's. It's probably not like that.
You're afraid
that.
You won't get them back?
You might not want everybody's fingers on them. But those earplugs come with filters for different purposes. So I'll pass these little filters around, and you can pop them in and out. They have them for music. They have them complete silence and shooting applications, those types of things. So keep in mind, protect your ears. There's lots of great sounds left out there to hear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I had no idea.
Thank you, Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I bet my music is way over 85.
Right. Yeah.
That I listen to.
About the size of a hearing aid battery.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. Commissioners, this morning we have an agenda before us. Is there any additions or changes that you think need to be made to that? And at the same time, I would add to the members of the public that it's at this time, if anybody wishes to have an item added to the agenda, the commission would consider that now. No guarantees, but would consider that if there was a request that came from the floor. Hearing no comments, I think we could move on to item 3, which is our regionalization study.
Okay. I want to invite Ron Slava to come up.
Good morning, commissioners. You might recall in end of December 2015, we requested and received a number of public power benefit requests from the public for projects that could do the best for the most for the longest to enhance the quality of life in Chelan County. One of the requests that we received was jointly submitted by the cities Leavenworth, Cashmere, and Chelan County to seek out regionalization opportunities in the water and wastewater utilities in the upper Wenatchee Valley. So specifically, Cashmere, Leavenworth, and Chelan PUD all operate water and wastewater utilities up the Wenatchee River. We all face some of the same challenges, such as dealing with water rights, water source, wastewater treatment, increasing regulations, and of course, aging infrastructure, just to name a few. Responding to these challenges all cost money and ultimately impact the rates that we charge our ratepayers. The purpose of this study is to seek out efficiencies and see that if we collaborate in one or more of several ways, if we can ultimately keep those costs down, perhaps increase the level of service, provide the same level of service, or keep the cost down for those services that are provided. In its simplest form, regionalization could be just combined billing, for example. PUD sends bills to all of our customers in Chelan County. Leavenworth and Cashmere also sends bills to their customers for water and wastewater services. So we have an opportunity to look at shared billing, for example. That's on one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum could be an actual merging of services under one ownership and operation structure. How we're going to move forward here, there's plenty of qualified consultants, utility financial consultants, that can come in and take a look at our current operations and make recommendations and perform financial feasibility analysis as to what benefits regionalization could offer. And that's what we plan to undertake this year. We'll, of course, engage the communities of all of those that are included in this effort. We would like to get one or more community advisors representing each utility and have regular meetings, of course, to make sure that we stay on track. We've already met a couple of times. We'll get together later this month. We want to finalize a request for proposals for consultants to get a consultant on board. So that'll take some time. Ideally, we'll have a consultant on board by about mid-year, by June, with a preliminary study issued by the end of the year, by December. I haven't mentioned that although the original request was submitted by the cities and Chelan County, The Chasson Water District is also here. They've expressed interest in participating in the study as well, so they have been added. So we have representatives of cities that's, I don't recall, the RCW Title 35, I believe, and Title 54 for the PUDs and Title 57 for the Water and Sewer District. So we're all well represented. They are here. If anybody like come up, make any comments, you have that opportunity.
Yeah, I didn't mention in my opening comments, and I should have, that we do have two mayors in the audience, if I note correctly, Mayor Farivar of Leavenworth and Mayor Gomes of Cashmere. So welcome. And
both have been very engaged in this process as well.
Any comments from any of the potential participants?
Whenever you ask for a comment, I generally. I'm Sherry Farivar, Mayor of Leavenworth. And hello, you all. We are very supportive of this. The initial request was a long time coming. We tried with Cashmere to figure out ways to achieve efficiency in our wastewater and water system. We really appreciate the PUD's willingness to take this on as a study, and we've had two or three meetings with your staff, Mr. Wright. And if you have any questions for us, we're happy to answer it. Other than that, I'm going to go sit down.
Okay, thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Steve Keene. I'm the chairman of the Community Council for Chasson and a commissioner with the Chasson Water District. We heard about this kind of a little bit later than the others, actually, but we are interested in it. We have our water district that is actually doing very well on its own for a small little community that we are. We just last year put in a brand new water tower to providing additional fire suppression. We were for several years under a building moratorium from the Department of Health because we didn't have sufficient pressure to supply any new growth in the area. So we addressed that issue. We were originally on the State Public Works Trust Fund list to get a loan for that. And of course, when that money went away, we had to figure out ways to do it ourselves. So we got financing ourselves to put in a tower that cost us $1.2 million. And for 200 and some customers, that's a lot of obligation there. But we are in good shape. We put in new pipelines and things back in 2003 and 2004, so the water district is in good shape. But we are looking at possible growth in the area with new housing developments and things, and what we would need to do to improve our infrastructure in town is a considerable project for us. We do have a lot of assets, and the fact that we have a lot of water and water rights. That's the wealth in Chasson. We don't have a lot of money. Our community is probably among the lowest in the per capita income in the county, and we have a small amount of customers for our district, but there are needs for growth, and that's what we're looking for, is to see how we can do that in our community and work together with other communities and with the PUD to see if we can make that happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to mention the fact that the water quality standards for the Wenatchee River watershed are much higher than the Columbia. So we all experience different problems, particularly with phosphorus removal and also obtaining water rights in the Wenatchee River drainage. So just like to mention.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right.
Alrighty. Any other questions from the commission?
Any questions? Any questions from any member of the audience? Steve?
And I would just say we don't need specific board action to move ahead. This was an inform and a test, really, just to see if there are any challenges. So we are planning to move ahead based on the work that we've done and the public comment that you've heard.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Item 4 is the Chelan and Leavenworth substation update.
I want to invite John Stoll to come up and review what happened in the recent public meetings that we held a little bit about where we might go from here.
That's what we're testing. Sorry, Steve. You just have to hold it a little bit closer, I think is the issue. It was recording.
Okay.
Well, good morning, Commissioners. I'm John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I'm going to be brief. I'll kind of set the table here, discuss the agenda, and then I'll turn it over to Chad Rissman, Andy Wendell, and Gary Rice to lead the bulk of this presentation. Just wanted to recognize that, you know, this has been, I think, about 18 months over both areas, kind of looking for a substation site for both Leavenworth and Chelan. There's been a lot of folks involved. I'd like to personally thank, I know Mayor Farivar has been very active, as well as Mayor Cooney in Chelan in providing support. We've used some of the city council meeting time to provide updates to both the community and the council, so I appreciate their active engagement. We've literally had dozens of meetings between that, special meetings, our advisory groups within the community, one-on-one meetings, so on and so forth. So this effort's been very active, very engaging. It's certainly, when everything's said and done and we've used this process for siting substations, we'll probably reflect back and, you know, see what the lessons learned or some opportunities to improve. But anyhow, again, I just wanted to appreciate all the active engagement from the community as well, and I think you see that here within the room. So here we are. You know, the intent of this meeting is to kind of recap a lot of those public meetings as well as provide this to the board in more of a formal setting. So I think you've seen the verbatim comments, the emails summarized. This presentation will have a fairly highly summarized recap of all that. But certainly this is now moving into a phase where it's certainly a direct board engagement for your questions as well. You know, again, today there's no decisions. This is strictly sharing information, although as much feedback as we provided to staff, that would be greatly appreciated. One of the things we did over the past month, and it was pretty aggressive, and I know Gary has been very active in working with the consulting engineer to look at the high-level cost estimates, the design. This was something, you know, again, where we're looking at multiple sites to try and understand as much as we possibly can, given that it is still fairly high level. But one thing I think has been clear, the costs are higher than traditional substation efforts. Leavenworth is interesting from the standpoint that there's some reliability issues. There's just lack of transmission that feeds that town. So when we look to add capacity, we're also looking at some reliability improvements. So that's what you'll see some of the cost drivers around that. On the Chelan side, there's been a very strong community desire to site a substation typically away from what our standard is, where we site it near the load. So we're looking certainly at more rural, out-of-the-way station sites. And with that, certainly you'll see some pretty high costs around that. You'll also hear that there's some trade-offs around that just from aesthetics. The substation itself in the load center has an aesthetic issue that we've heard, but now we're certainly understanding more of the what we're calling the wire in the air to get that power from that remote substation site back to where it's needed, and certainly that's a bit of an aesthetic trade-off. The other thing that I think is important to note around when we do something like that, again, it's you know, it will have initially a higher cost, but there's also a higher O&M cost, operations and maintenance, because you are certainly adding more infrastructure to get that power back to the areas where it needs. And with that, there's a little bit of a risk to reliability. So if you think about a fire that may go through and burn down, you know, what typically may be transmission lines, it's not easy, but it's a pretty quick repair. You know, we do it all the time. But when you introduce other elements like distribution systems, that will just potentially complicate things. So it's something as we kind of just understand the pros and cons of this type of situation. It's coming to bear. With that, just wanted to say, you know, we have spent quite a few months doing this, and as we saw in January, the loads are growing. We hit an all-new system peak, and even when you look at the substations specifically, they are reaching peak. So We've taken the time we need to, but we are certainly running out of that time to get substations put in the areas that they need to serve the load that we see coming at us that's already being planned and developed. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chad, Gary, and Andy.
John, before you go, is that your today's agenda? You didn't really talk about next steps and timeline.
Can you help us
with timeline? Because I remember hearing you say at one point you'd like to have a decision by the end of March.
Well, that's what we put as a agency goal. Now, certainly that, you know, that's not hard and fast, but back to the point for March right now, this is obviously another opportunity to provide input. We do plan on coming back at the next board meeting with the potential that we would have sites selected or a process to move forward on. But again, that's up to the board to make that call.
Okay, I'm hearing that the end of March. Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks, John. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service. To my left is...
Yeah, Gary Rice, Engineering Project Management.
And Chad Rissman, Director of Distribution, Asset Management, and Engineering.
So we'll be brief here on the lead-in so Gary can get to the information you're probably most interested in, which is the cost-benefit analyses around those various sites. I did just want to pause, and in addition to John's comments, I just wanted to thank the community focus group. We reached out asking for participants both in Chelan and Leavenworth, and some very brave souls came forward to engage with our internal team to endeavor on trying to find some substation sites that met the district's operational needs as well as was appropriate for the community. Through that process, we've learned that aesthetics is a major concern for many customers, as is reliability. And I think that today we'll see kind of that contrast between aesthetics and some of the operational considerations that we focus on when siting substations. So Gary will have an opportunity to get in to depth there. Just keep in mind that we were tasked with bringing the board three potential sites for each area, Chelan and Leavenworth. We did that with the principle that we needed to find sites that were considered available, meaning the property owner was willing to talk with us and gave us the consent to go ahead and study those properties. That endeavor took us a little bit of time to find those two things, a willing property owner and somebody willing to allow us to study those sites. So it's fair to say that we do have three for each Chelan and Leavenworth. However, there were several others that were under consideration, but for one reason or another, they became unavailable, or the property owners no longer wanted to consider them as part of the district's evaluation process. So, as we mentioned, Gary has worked with a consulting firm to provide some detailed engineering and cost analyses, specifically kind of the geotechnical portion of the sites, where they're physically located, and some of the physical requirements, such as the mobile substation, getting transmission in and distribution lines out. So he'll go into detail there. Both Gary, Chad, and I attended the February 13th meeting in Leavenworth. Was well attended. There was upwards of 30, 35 people there. Some great dialogue around the various sites, and we'll be providing you some just high-level customer feedback during that meeting, and then additional emails and other comments, phone calls, and things that have come in since that time. And the same on February 22nd in Chelan. We were there. We got some great customer feedback. We've received lots of comments during the meeting, after the meeting, as well as emails and other phone calls. So it's fair to say that it's been a very collaborative process with the community, and we've certainly heard from them in many venues. Just one last comment is we have, I think, come together with the community in an understanding that the timing is becoming more and more critical now. As John mentioned, we've been at this for 18 months, and I don't think any of us had anticipated taking 18 months to get to where we are today. But we recognize internally that we're needing to take some action sooner than later. I don't know that we could afford an additional 18 months on this. Chad probably has a little bit better idea of when that critical time is, but the point we wanted to make today is the community is very much aware of the timing aspect that the district is concerned with. I just wanted to mention the list of stakeholders that that we've attempted to engage or have been participative in this process. Again, through a stakeholder engagement process, we want to get both public and private folks involved. We really appreciate both the City of Leavenworth and the City of Chelan being very active in this process and helping foster good community dialogue. We've worked with the public works folks and other public officials. The city councils, both in Chelan and Leavenworth, are very active in this process as well. As I mentioned, we had two teams, focus group members. I think each team had probably 8 or 10 people in addition to PUD staff meeting on a regular basis to look at site criteria and reach agreement on site criteria and evaluate various sites as a result. We've heard from developers in both Chelan and Leavenworth and their thoughts around the substations, as well as the private property owners, both property owners that we've talked to with regard to the sites that they specifically own that we are interested in addition to many of the adjacent property owners. I think it's fair to say some of those are here today, and we'll likely hear from them. We've worked with some homeowner associations and other interest groups and other community members. So we feel it was a broad spectrum of stakeholders in the community, and both Chelan and Leavenworth, we believe, were fairly represented overall. So with that, we'll start with Leavenworth, and Gary will walk you through the analyses and information found.
Thank you, Andy. Starting with Leavenworth, the recent community group meeting that we had was February 13th. Prior to that, we did have the focus group together and had a similar meeting. And at that meeting, we provided to the community a review of the consulting engineer's findings. I've been working with the consulting engineer since last fall. And once we honed in on three different sites, specific sites, we did in-house surveying on those sites, land surveying, that is, and then followed with a very preliminary general arrangement. And then we were able to do earthwork calculations and begin coming up with the components that we needed to provide cost estimates. Part of that also was to come up with a circuit analysis where we would likely go with the power coming out of the substation. So you'll see that also. All right, this is the first slide for Leavenworth. As you can see in your upper left-hand corner, we have three sites identified. When we started the process, we actually had about 15 different areas, and then we, with the help of the focus group, we took those areas and we grouped them and tried to narrow down to specific areas that may have willing owners that might serve well electrically, and also considered aesthetics considerations. The three sites you see there, to get an idea of where they are, the lowest orange dot is actually near the PUD headquarters. That's the site of our existing substation. That substation does have two transformers in it, so it is serving double capacity. The reason I bring that up is with each transformer, you get to have four circuits to go out in different directions and serve the community with power. That site only has 7 circuits serving right now. One of them is considered stranded. We just don't have a good way to get it out. And I bring that up just because that site, that area, is fairly congested electrically. The other two sites that you see, the one up to the left, that's the Upper Valley Mend property. And is just on the backside of Rattlesnake Hill. The one to the right is city property. That's actually the bottom of Rattlesnake Hill on the backside, and just right next to the Chumstick Highway. And this is just the high-level summary sheet. I wanted to prepare a one-page summary sheet. And it has some detail in there, but the high-level points I want to bring out was once we did the consultant evaluation, by looking at the costs and the different categories that we had for the cost, which were earthwork, the substation itself, that's all the equipment and building of the substation, distribution costs, that's getting the power out of the substation, and transmission costs, that's getting the power into the substation. With each of those, when you compare them together, there's some obvious things with cost that you see, and there's a reason for each of those. Site 8A being built on the backside of Rattlesnake Hill, it's on a slope site, and it's in the trees, and there's quite a bit of earthwork that would need to be done. Where a typical substation is 1 acre, we figured we'd need about 2 acres of property there in order to lay the slopes back, and then also deal with the rocks that we believe are in that site. So there's a level of contingency in that earthwork cost also. The site 14 is the Mend property, and it has the one outlier that we found with it, other than the aesthetics, just from a construction standpoint, is we know it has high groundwater. We know that we're going to have some issues dealing with groundwater at that site. And site 9, just from a really high level, I wanted to mention that it is very congested electrically. We already have a substation at that site, and we already have a hard time getting the distribution out of that site. So with a new substation at Site 9, we'd be adding one more transformer, which would constitute that new substation, and that would allow us to get out with 4 more circuits. So we do have a plan for getting those 4 circuits out. As far as expandability goes in the future, usually we like to build a substation so we have future expansion capabilities. So we make the site large enough that you can bring in a second transformer in the future and get an additional 4 circuits. That may be 15, 20 years down the line. Both Site 8A and 14 have that ability. We didn't believe that Site 9 did, so I wanted to bring out that point. Each of these estimates, because they're high level, we put a 20% contingency on those, and the transmission component actually has a 30% contingency because there's a few more unknowns with transmission. So with all that said, if you just take a quick glance at the Leavenworth properties, all of them are, you know, from low to high, we're within about 5%. So they're all fairly tightly packed in there. So you're really looking at all the other considerations as opposed to cost if you're looking at all of them together. All right, this is the Site 8A. This is the city property on the backside of Rattlesnake Hill, right next to the Chumstick Highway. And what we show in this slide, and you'll see it in the others also, is green is the green lines are the transmission coming in, the new transmission coming in, and the yellow lines are the distribution going out. So we labeled each of those 4 circuits where we'd propose to go with those. So you can see where they'll connect into the existing grid. So you, circuit 1 and 2 go over to Titus Road, and then circuit 3 and 4 go over to the Chumstick Highway or in that vicinity. Each one of them tie in and go a different direction. I mean, it's a pretty logical way to get out. And we do have, other than the earthwork, you know, some aesthetic concerns, like we do with all the sites. One of them is as you come down the Chumstick Highway, you do end up looking right into that site. There's things that we can do as far as walls and landscaping and different considerations once you get into further into design to try to camouflage or hide a substation. I went out since the transmission component is always a concern because if you're adding new transmission, the poles are quite a bit larger. So where I say board number one right here, that shows the transmission number one line coming from our existing substation site, and that board number one is over here where Chad's pointing. And what we've done is we've, on the left, we have the existing condition. And then on the right, you see what would have to happen to put transmission on it. The poles would change, and they grow about 20 feet in height. And then we'd also have distribution hung on those poles, which are the wires down lower. So that's a view about from the county shop looking up the Chumstick. Okay, the second transmission line that I've shown, and is this upper route. That's an existing distribution route, but it's a new transmission line. So it would be very similar. I'll have Chad go ahead and show that one on board too. I actually show two different perspectives. The perspective that Chad is showing is right at the railroad crossing just past the Amtrak station where you have the railroad bridge. So on the...
Excuse me, is that North Road?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is North Road. Yeah, just as you're making the turn to go underneath the railroad bridge. So on the right, you can see the existing distribution line that's there. And then on the left, what you see... Oh, who's left, who's right? Yeah, distribution would be on the left as we show. And then on the right, you see the taller transmission line with the distribution underneath. And with that, we're just placing existing distribution back onto it. This is the route that John Stoll had mentioned was the addition to reliability to the area of Leavenworth. This line, if it went in, what it would allow us to do is feed from separate paths and be able to have the capability to feed the substation from two different sources. Right now, the existing substation has the capability of being fed from two separate sources, but there's a chunk of that that goes from the railroad tracks, if you can see my pointer on the screen, along through an orchard, across Chumstick Creek, and then it comes in behind the county shop area to the substation. That's a single pole line that actually has two transmission circuits on it. That, if we lose any component of that pole line, then the power's down to the city and we don't have a redundant feed. If we're able to build the upper transmission line, then we could feed actually any of the substations from either of the transmission lines. And it also helps just with operation and operation of the substations. Probably not explaining that as clearly as I could, but the second transmission line is pretty important for reliability.
Gary, the line that you're showing us now, is that different than this one right here at the corner from the
from the train station. Mm-hmm. Okay, I showed two different perspectives along this transmission 2 route. One of them was right at the train station and the bridge.
Oh, there's the corner right there.
The other one was from the cemetery road, looking back along the orchards. There you go. And what's not showing on that picture, because we did a before and after, it cut out the houses to the right. There's a lot of new construction in that area on the North Road itself. But that does follow an existing distribution route. So yeah, good catch. We have two renderings of the transmission distribution line for that transmission 2 route. The board number 3 that we have is actually the rendering that we had done for the men's site. And you can see the new transmission going right at the base of Rattlesnake Hill up tight against the hill there. We would have the opportunity to take a look during a connector road design of whether we wanted that to go up against the hill or if we wanted to go a little bit further out into the field. Those design details haven't been worked out yet. But it does show both transmission lines very similar to what we have with our existing substation site. Both transmission lines on one pole line, and then in addition to that, there's two distribution lines, circuit 3 and circuit 4, coming out of the substation at site 14 back towards the Chumstick Highway. So this is the layout that we have for both Chelan and Leavenworth. As we go through the presentation, you'll see this same similar information. As we move to site 9, Site 9 is a district site, and we have an existing substation. These purple lines that you see are existing transmission, and then the red is existing distribution. The yellow is new distribution, and then we have very little new transmission because what we're showing is we're locating that at a site, or at the existing substation site, so we already have transmission coming to it. But what you have is the two feeder lines coming in on the same pole line for transmission to an existing substation with two transformers that has 7 of the 8 circuits going out of it already. And then we're adding 4 more circuits. So what we showed was we'd have one go over to Titus Road, kind of following the same path as either the site 8A or 14. And then we had 3 circuits coming and back south. But it is a fairly congested system. And the cost for site 9, the reason that they showed higher is when you get that kind of congestion, you have special switching that needs to occur. So that switching, you either have a breaker and a half configuration, they call it, or a ring bus. So within the substation area itself, we would be adding the new substation just adjacent to it, the new transformer. And then in order to accomplish switching with 2 feeder lines coming in and potentially 12 circuits going out, there's quite a bit of operational impacts in doing that safely. That does raise the cost of all the additional equipment. Following the, through the process, I should say, we had public comment come in. We have just a component of the public comment here. And we know we have people in the audience that may want to get up and speak as well. And there was a pretty good public push to go ahead and put it on PUD property, the site number 9. But electrically, that makes it pretty difficult to do, not to say that it couldn't be done. Both 8A and 14 had aesthetic impacts, as well as a couple construction impacts, but we figured we could work our way through the construction impacts anyway. The aesthetic impacts would be a later phase to try to figure out how to camouflage the substations the best that we could if we do choose a site at either the 8A or 14 locations. There was more comment that came in talking about a site number 10. And if you remember back when I was talking about how the group put together 15 different areas and then grouped those into tighter areas as we began to narrow the process, there was one area that had both sites 9, 10, and 11 in it. And that's really the PUD property area, and then stretching a little bit to the south and a little bit to the north. The south site, the site 11, was the railroad's capped area at the intersection going up the Chumstick. That site itself, just off of PUD property, is owned by the railroad. It would be very visible in town. We didn't feel that was a very good site. Sure, I'm back here. We're looking at this area right here. That cap is almost, or the soil treatment apparently is almost done. That site may become available, but it would be, we would do our best on camouflaging that site for sure. The PUD site is right here. And then the last site was somewhere around the county pit area. There's a few lots right in here that are don't have buildings built on them and that may be available if we wanted to look closer at that. The further south you go, the more you're dealing with the transmission lines and the congestion. And if we are a little further north, it may be a little more favorable, but we still have the issues of getting circuits out and getting the power where we want it to be. So we didn't analyze anything more than our site 9, and there was comment to maybe analyze site 10 a little bit closer.
That's right on the highway, right?
It's actually not. There's a back road. It's the county, I think it's called County Shop Road. Oh. Yeah, and if you turn off that County Shop Road, right along there, there's a log. Don't know exactly what they do there. Log outfit. A whole bunch of logs there. It used to be maybe an old junkyard, automotive junkyard. One thing to point out, though, is that area, this county shop in this area, it's one of the few, if not the only, commercial industrial-type area that Leavenworth has for development. And we would be taking a large chunk of that, you know, a full acre, acre and a half, if we built a substation there. That would displace future growth in an economic way in Leavenworth.
I think that property is specifically zoned for commercial or industrial usage.
So those were the public comments, and I'd like to open it up to any other comments you may have on Leavenworth, and then maybe we could hear from the community.
Good idea. Questions or comments from commissioners?
one question I have, Gary, is this rendering over here, as you move the lines out into the field, you see more detail, where just struck me as it's closer to the hill site than it blends in with that.
Yeah, are you talking about the lines around the substation itself?
Just the lines around the substation. So my question is it possible to come along the hill and turn into the substation so it's not quite as visible out in the field?
Yeah, we looked at that, and it is, but what the issue is you have to get a mobile sub into it. So a mobile substation is pulled with a semi and a lowboy, and as it comes in, it has to turn around. So you have to enter the substation, then turn around. So when it's halfway through its turn, it needs to sit underneath those transmission poles. So the way we have it located right now at the far end of the substation, there's lots of room to drive in, turn around the backside of the substation, park it, and come out. If we pulled those poles back just as tight as we could so that we could still get that mobile substation in there, it would probably push the footprint of the substation out by another about a half an acre. So it would use a little more land, but we could surely pull those back as close as we could. It would bring them back maybe two-thirds of the way back towards the front of the substation, but then it would require a little more land.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from commissioners before I ask the public? Public input on what's been presented up to this point. I knew I could count on you, Mayor.
Thank you. This has been a really, I don't know how to describe this process with our city. I know that the PUD determined early on that they wanted to do this in a fashion where the outreach was such that the community came up with the sites and not the PUD coming up with the sites. And that has worked exceptionally well for Leavenworth. Our little subcommittee that identified the sites and then took the, I don't know, has it been 18 months really? Yeah, wow.
A long time.
Yeah, a long time, right. And I think that we really have determined two of the best sites. I think the PUD site, the PUD property site, is indeed a little bit problematic for all of the engineering and technical reasons that these gentlemen identified. Either of the other two sites, one of them owned by the city and the other one owned by Upper Valley Mend, are both good sites, and the city is in support of either one of those two. But I will say that and the city is a willing seller of the city site, but I will say that Mend is an exceptionally willing seller. They're very willing to have the substation on that site for several really good reasons. One of them is economic. They are financially would like to sell a piece of property. The second one is that the PUD would have to be building a road to get into there, which would definitely benefit their property. And of course, the city would be probably taking some involvement in that. So I would say that the chairperson of Mend, or the chairman of the board of Mend, couldn't be here today. I am not speaking for him on his behalf with his permission, but in our meetings it has been evident that they are a very willing seller. And that seems to be one of the favored sites as a result of its topography being level, its access being good, and aesthetics. I perceive that a substation becomes somewhat invisible. And in this case, I think that Steve McKenna's idea of switching or tightening it up, even though it might take a little extra land, is a really good idea. So I think that you'll find the fact that nobody's here to protest the building of the substation on either of these sites is a result of the fact that the PUD in the city and our focus group did such a good idea identifying and answering all of those questions throughout this process. So if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them. Other than that, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. The input is really helpful. Appreciate you guys coming and sharing. Thank you.
Okay. I think we're good.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to the Chelan sites now and talk about those.
Gary?
Yes.
Sorry. While I still have Mayor Farivar here, Sherry, the comments that came in about the Site 10 on the industrial area, has the city changed its stance on what you would like to see or not see?
No, indeed. That Site 10 was eliminated for one major reason, and a very good one, and that is that it is indeed the only industrial zoned parcel that we have inside the city limits. Mm-hmm. Leavenworth has a very small footprint. Our municipal boundaries are, I'm going to ask the boss over here, 1.38 square miles. Wow. And Leavenworth is so the constriction of this area does not allow us to put an industrial location really anywhere else in our town. This has been zoned industrial and is being used industrially. Although it is a log yard, that parcel is a log yard at the present, it is owned by a local company that is holding it for investment until such a time as the industrial pressure would ask them to sell it. So we would recommend against that site for that reason only, that we really do want some economic development on that site. And the fact that it is our only industrial zone in Leavenworth is fairly critical to our small town. Did that answer your question?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Gary, the last question I have on that is that does not, in that site, increase our redundancy ability at Site 10. Is that correct?
It could. We could still take that second route line into Site 10.
Thank you.
Just the one, add one little thing to that Area 10 there. That is currently under a review by a developer to look at that site and expand their business in that area. So I'm not sure of the availability. They've been looking at it for about 3 or 4 months now, so I'm thinking something's going to come along. Okay.
Thank you, Joel.
All right, that's all there is on Leavenworth for now. We'll move on to Chelan. About 9 days later, we had a community group meeting in Chelan. The Chelan effort was originally moving ahead of the Leavenworth effort, and then they kind of switched as we got more input in Chelan. But we had our consultant hurry and try to catch up with that. So what we do have now are some before and after pictures of transmission lines. Originally at this meeting, we didn't have those before and after pictures, the renderings. What we did have was just renderings of the substations themselves, what they may look like. So we did get new information following that commission or following that community group meeting that we have now. Chad will put those up as we go through here. What you see in front of you now is the overall top view of the whole Chelan area, identifying in those blue circles the three sites that we have for Chelan. Electrically, as John mentioned, we'd like to have a substation as close to the load center as we could. That line is the blue line that you see on the drawing, that blue vertical line, light blue line. So we want to be as close to that as we can. That'll reduce the amount of distribution that we have trying to get feed back to the load center. The three sites that we did end up with are the Washington Mutual site, clear to the right. That's above the golf course. We ended up with one out in the middle of an orchard that actually has a fairly lengthy access road that would need to go to it, and easements aren't worked out on that either. The third site that we have is a little further out, and it is along a roadway, and from a substation general arrangement standpoint, it works out pretty well, but it does have a lot longer distribution to get the load back to the load center. On this drawing, just to orient everyone, the two yellow lines that you see are existing transmission lines. The lower one is the Chelan-Manson line. The upper one is the Chelan-Wapato line. So those are both existing transmission lines. One thing that we do when we're, well, I shouldn't say one thing that we do, we don't, I don't know if we've ever done it, but we're looking further out than we typically do. So in doing so, in order to get circuits back to where the load's needed, and you have, I guess, what we're calling an express feeder. It's a distribution line that follows underneath the transmission line. That's one way to get the power back to the load center if there's no other place, no other existing locations to go. So that express feeder, as it comes back, that's the type of distribution line that we don't touch. We don't serve homes off of it. We just use it to get the load back. So with any of these sites that we're looking at in Chelan, since there's not the growth there now that would really require them, like in Leavenworth, we knew that we could come out in four different directions with those four different feeders, and we could get to locations we needed to be. We didn't really have that case in Chelan, so we had like three directions that we could go with each one of them. So what we ended up doing was one of those circuits, we put a dual distribution line on. So as we go through this, that's what you'll see is we go three different directions instead of four, and one of those directions is doubled up with distribution to get that load where we need it to go.
While we're still looking at the map, what's the approximate distance from one edge of the map to the other? Give a sense of scale.
Is it about 3 miles? About 3.5 to 4 miles.
We're looking at three to 4 miles.
Yeah, and to let you know what the sites are, I didn't mention the names. Yes, I was trying that. I was referring to the log site. I didn't want to mention the owner's name. So on this one, this is the Washington Federal Savings Site by the golf course. It's the Chelan Hills or Chelan Heights site in the center out in the orchard. That orchard property owner, you can see the property lines on this. He owns a fairly large chunk of property there, 300 or 400 acres, I believe, or maybe 500. The other site is the Urich site. That property owner owns maybe not a full orchard, but he does have some orcharding activity on that site.
Can't write on your slick paper.
No. Office Services gave you the best paper we had. All right. Very similar to Leavenworth, I wanted to show just a one-pager here and just talk about some high-level attributes of each of the sites. So you see the cost there, and one of them is lower than the other two, the Chelan Heights site. And it is lower in cost, but it has a couple problems with it that's been identified both by our engineering department and also the community. It sits out on a knoll, even though it's out kind of in the middle of nowhere, one would think. That middle of nowhere is within view of Boyd Loop Road, several different areas, and also property owners that would look down and see the substation built there. It also has a long access road that's not really considered it's improved for orchard purposes. It's not improved for year-round access by a mobile substation. So there would be some cost and long-term cost maintaining that road going forward if we built in that site. Like all the sites, it still has quite a bit of distribution, more than we typically see. You can see about 4.3 miles of overhead distribution on that site to get the power where it needs. That would be adding up all of the circuits, getting them to where they need to go. If we move to the Urich site, that was the one that was furthest towards Manson. It is located pretty well along a good access road. It does have good power coming right next to it. That's on the upper transmission line, the Chelan-Wapato line, but it's that much further out. And with it being that much further out, we just have more distribution. We're up to about 6.9 miles of overhead distribution. We also have some underground distribution, which I'll explain once we get to the specific site. Wanted to bring up one more point. When we're building along the existing transmission lines with that underbuild distribution, those existing poles aren't designed maybe from a structural standpoint, but also from an electrical regulation standpoint. There needs to be a certain amount of distance between the ground and the conductors. And if we put dual distribution on those lines, the poles have to grow in height. And you also have to have a height difference between the distribution line and the transmission line on the same pole. So in these cost estimates are a per structure replacement cost that we have on those lines that also serve to drive the price up. We put those costs in the distribution because it's driven by distribution, even though it's on a transmission line. So you don't see it in the transmission component. The Washington Federal site has a lot less overhead distribution, mainly because it's built pretty close to an existing residential area and the golf course. So we have to match the existing infrastructure that we have there, which is underground. So you see a large amount of underground on the Washington Federal site. Underground is quite a bit more expensive than distribution is. With our cost estimating that the consultant gave to us, the distribution overhead for a double circuit was $98 a foot, and it was $292 a foot for underground. So that $194 cost differential is the cost differential for going underground. So even though the total miles are leased with the Washington Federal site, it's pretty heavy in underground distribution, which drives the cost up. So that's what brings its cost up high, similar to the URIC site. Yes.
What is the distance of the underground? How much distance are we talking?
1.7 miles, or excuse me, 3.2 miles.
3.2 miles, all underground.
All underground. I'll explain this a little more once we get to the URIC orchard. We also have 1.4 miles of underground on the URIC orchard, but that's single circuit versus dual circuit, and it's in a location that we already had existing distribution on the transmission line, but I'll get into that a little bit more when we get to the slide. The contingency, again, is 20% on everything. I might mention that for Leavenworth, the difference in cost between the low and the high alternative was only about 5%. Here it's about 35%. So that's just as we get pushed out further and further, the attributes of the specific sites have components such as underground distribution or and overhead distribution by way of the express feeder that adds cost to it. All right, we're going to start with the Chelan Heights site. That's the one that was in the middle. If we take a look here, we'll talk about the Chelan Heights and then the URIC and then the Washington Federal. The Chelan Heights site, like I say, the access road is clear over almost a mile away through the orchard to get out to it. It sits on a little bit of a knoll out there. It's an area that the orchardist doesn't currently have orchard on. It used to be old orchard, but he doesn't intend to put additional orchard onto it. So when we sent our mailers out asking for sites, and the property owner contacted us back and said, yeah, I think I have a good site right underneath the transmission line. And he's right, he's got a great site right underneath the transmission line that also has aesthetic and visual impacts to it. But it is located right at the intersection of distribution and transmission, which is very good for laying out the circuits and tying into transmission. So you see a very small component of the underground on this site. We like to go out of substations underground rather than overhead, and we go underground just a short distance, 300 or 400 feet, until we intersect distribution lines to get the power out. So on the URIC site, you can see circuit number one going down towards the lake, circuit number two going back up a little bit to the east, and then where I'd mentioned before on the express feeders, following the route of an existing transmission line, we would put two circuits. That one otherwise stranded circuit would come along the straight section of the transmission line that you see here, the Chelan-Wapato line or Chelan-Manson line, and it would come clear back to the population where it could go into existing underground distribution circuits. We do have a visual there that we'll use for all three sites, board A, and this is actually taken on the Chelan Manson corridor. So you can see off to the left, that's the existing transmission line that we have. And to the right, you can see what it would turn into. You can see the two vertically stacked feeder circuits, distribution lines, and then the existing lines would go up above. The structure has to grow to meet the clearances that we have to have. So that line, since it travels such a great distance and it does go through developed areas, and it would be in the way of several people's views, who some of them overlook that line right now, but as the line would raise another 20 feet or so, it may become in their view or complicate their view with the distribution lines. The URIC site is actually very similar to the Chelan Heights site. The area that I'm pointing right now is the Chelan Heights site. So we basically, we have pretty much everything that we had with the Chelan Heights site. We just add distance to get the feeders out, because the URIC site is on the backside of this hill right over here along the Boyd Loop Road and Winesap intersections. So what we do is we propose taking circuit number one down into a populated area, following an existing overhead line that doesn't actually require upgrading its size properly to get our load down there. We would have circuit number two following the Chelan Wapato line and going a pretty great distance to get down to the golf course area to tie in. Where you see rebuilt overhead identified, that means we would follow an existing distribution line, but what we would do is we would reconductor that line. We would put larger conductors on it to carry the extra load, but the line, for all essential purposes, would look very similar. And then we get down to an underground area. The circuits 3 and 4 that Chad just showed you with the rendering would come along the Chelan-Wapato or Chelan-Manson line, and it would feed all the way down into down around the area we have shown here, and then go double underground to get into an existing development and a future development area. We showed board B on this also, and that's a portion of the Chelan Wapato line that we would need to get the distribution down to the Chelan Manson line. So we would have a location with an existing transmission line you see on the left, and then we would build a line that would be very similar to the board A that you just saw, with dual distribution on it. The problem is that line already has a distribution line on it, and we can't put three distribution lines on it. So that's the underground section that I was talking about, that's 1.4 miles on this alternative. It's a little bit cheaper to put just one circuit underground than two, of course, so it's slightly cheaper per foot underground. And then the third illustration we wanted to show is the upper line, the Chelan Wapato line. And it's more in a rural area. There is still some housing on there, and we don't have all of the, we do have easements for putting underbuild on that line from an easement standpoint. I'd like to thank our transmission department for having these photographs. What you're seeing with two out of the three of these here are lines that they worked on recently and took a picture before they did the work on the line. So they sent that to us. And then the HDR engineering is the one that did the renderings for us to show us what they would look like. So those are the three illustrations we have. We'll have a fourth one as we look at the fourth site, the Washington Federal Savings site. So I have that up now. You can see the same board A description of the existing transmission line that would have to be rebuilt. This is not the same section of transmission line that I showed you on the other two alternatives. This essentially picks up where they left off and goes east. There is an overlap section, short overlap section, depending on which alternative you choose. If we chose the, I believe it was either the Uric or the Chelan site, it runs a little bit longer. I could clarify that. I just don't remember which one it is. But there is a short section of property that I'm showing you here that under any of the alternatives would have the dual distribution built across and in front of them. So with the Washington Federal site, this is a proposed and planned and partially constructed development. There's a paved road section of that development existing, and then it goes into a gravel road section. We're proposing to go up towards the gravel road section. We actually contacted the bank that now owns the property, and they gave us two locations to take a look at. One of them was too small, and it was further east. And then the second one they gave us was the site of existing fill from building out their development. But right next to that was a good site. So we talked to the bank and said, would you consider selling the site next to you? They said, well, consider selling about any site, but yeah, you can take a look at that one. But they haven't come forward like the other property owners have and said, yes, we're a willing seller. We're willing to have you take a look at the sites, is what they have told us. So the substation site for Western Federal would be located in the area I have you shown here. It's actually on the backside of a small hill that would somewhat camouflage it from the golf course. But in order to get to that site, unlike the other two sites, since it's not right next to the transmission line, there would need to be a short section of transmission line built. That's what you see in green, and that's just right next to us. So to the right, you see an existing transmission line. To the left, we see an existing transmission line. To the right, we see a transmission line built about 10 feet to the right of where the old one was, and it's about 20 feet taller. And we're showing it here with distribution under it, but I do want to make a point in saying that where we're showing this perspective, we wanted to illustrate what distribution would look like on it, but from this particular perspective, that section wouldn't get the distribution on it, and it wouldn't be rebuilt in that section. This is just what it would look like on the rest of it. Wanted to bring that point clear because going across the golf course, we're not proposing that we put distribution under build at the golf course location or change those poles. It would be beyond the golf course. What's also shown in the right photo is the transmission line, that green transmission line going up to the Washington Federal substation site if it were chosen. You can see those three wires. And the reason you've got three is you have to have transmission into the substation, then transmission coming out. Total of six, three stacks of two. So we wanted to clearly show what that would look like. You would be able to see that from the golf course, and you would be able to see it from adjacent properties. We tried to find a location that there's actually a natural depression in the earth there, so we could, you know, camouflage it the best that we could to get up to that location. The three circuit paths that we show for the Washington Federal, and much of it's underground getting out. Circuit number two comes down underground along the border of Noceum Orchards and the golf course property, and then follows routes underground to get the power where it needs to be. Circuit three, very similarly, follows a roadway coming down the Union Valley area until it hits existing transmission line, and then we'd have to put larger conductor on that, existing distribution line. We have to put larger conductor on that distribution line. That's where it calls it out as rebuilt overhead. The other site, remember how I said that we need to have four circuits, but we really only have three paths. We chose the path that we could get power on circuit one and circuit four, following along the existing transmission line with an express feeder to get the power where it would need to be for future growth and existing growth or existing houses. So you can see Washington Federal has quite a bit more underground, but does still have a transmission corridor where we would like to put distribution on it, or would need to put distribution on it. We got a lot of public comment in Chelan as well. a lot of it surrounding aesthetics. We're kind of getting pushed different directions, I kind of feel, because we're doing the best we can to solve it, but we follow within existing rules and guidelines. And as we get pushed out further, we have to start building on transmission lines, which impact other people's views. So kind of the highlight, the Chelan Heights site, it's viewable. The substation itself is viewable from a lot of perspectives. It's built out on a knoll. It is under a transmission line, which looks good to us, and it has more difficult access, even though we could access. We could physically build a substation out there and take care of all the problems fairly easily, but it has some aesthetic concerns. The URIC site is well located, just quite a ways away, so we're having to build more of those transmission lines that have distribution under them. And the Washington Federal site is fairly costly, just with the amount of underground that we have to build out to get the power where it needs to be. If we could find a site that was closer to the load center, those underground costs would go down because we'd have less of it, and the feeder line costs would go down also, building underneath the transmission lines. I cover all three? So with that, I know we have several different people wanting to get up and speak about the Chelan Heights site, but I'd like to first see if there's anyone with the commission that would like to give any comment before.
Commissioner, questions, comments?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I still recall the wildfire season of a few years back when power was lost in Chelan, and as we look at any of these routes, a question pops in my mind, is one preferable to another with respect to wildfire and the potential for wildfire given its location?
Yeah, I'm assuming that wildfire doesn't burn a city down, the Washington Federal site is probably a better site because it has less overhead distribution. So much of it is underground. And in the future, it will be built out with housing around it. It is in a location where housing will eventually be built up around it, I'm pretty confident. And then with that comes green belts, and it's just inherently protected because it would then be in the city.
Thank you.
The one question I had, after the, this had to do with building on the Washington Federal and purchasing the Ulrich site, and that direct feed out the Wapato line, does, by using that scenario of building now and purchasing for later, does that create a benefit for us? Does it reduce that direct line out towards Wapato, towards Manson, and does it do anything for us?
It changes a lot. One of the things that stands out mostly for me is that you have a planning known. So once we have a future site identified and picked out, we can perform specific planning tasks or projects around that, including managing the growth and working with developers and working with the city and the county to build out the distribution consistent with the growth or alongside the growth. So that's the biggest impact in my mind, is we have a known plan. To answer the second question, yes, it would reduce the amount of infrastructure. What we're trying to accomplish with the URIC site as it is right now, without another site mm-hmm. on board where we're considering the Washington Federal, the distribution infrastructure is trying to get back to that load center line. Mm-hmm. If that load center line was largely being served from the Washington Federal in the scenario that you identified, the infrastructure then down the road would not need to come down from the URIC site, that it would more than likely serve closer to Manson, somewhere between the Wapato station and the Washington Federal site. So yes, it would reduce the amount of infrastructure. But I think the biggest benefit of that is we would have a known planning site, and we'd be able to work around that for future growth. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Probably really difficult to put a dollar figure on that at this point. The known planning scenario, the issue about the load center.
Always going to be less expensive to work with other planned projects, and you have sort of a economic benefit associated with accomplishing multiple goals with one project. So as an example of that, there's a development that's being built, and you know you have a future site, so there might be a sharing of the costs, or costs if they're not that incremental, by the developer to install future infrastructure, so you have a path going through there. So you sort of get this economy of scale.
So it's significant.
Significant.
Do you have an estimate if you built on the Washington Trust and you didn't build that extended distribution line because you purchased the property of the Ulrich, what would be the savings of not putting that line in?
So if we built both stations, we would still have similar infrastructure. Let me see if I understand your question and ask it again.
Or maybe let me back up. Would you have to build the Ulrich station at this point, or would that be a future?
That would be a future location that would be driven by the growth in the area,
right,
between the Washington Federal.
So what I'm getting at is then, so if that's future and you're not putting in that direct feed, is that a direct distribution feed backwards? Would you be saving, what would be the current savings?
There wouldn't be a savings because, can you, Gary, flip to the Washington Federal site? So with the Washington Federal site, we're trying to get to where the current need is. You see that circuit?
This one here?
Mm-hmm.
That's under building the transmission line. What we're trying to do is get up to, for those of you that are familiar with this area, this is Boyd and the High Point Junction, like above Legacy Ridge there.
Yep.
So we're trying to get distribution capacity in that area where we're experiencing growth. Electricity is a very analogous to water. Think of a substation as being a water reservoir and the distribution lines being pipes. We need to carry from the reservoir to where the water demand is. So if we purchased the UIRC site into the future, there is a current need for electricity, or in the analogy, water, to be located where the demand is now.
Okay.
So it's a long way of answering your question. We would not be able to reduce the infrastructure planned for the Washington Federal build-out if the UIRC site was a future substation.
I see.
Although, to add on to that, if the Washington Federal was built out, and then when it came time to build out the UIRC, this upper line that you see that's very long wouldn't be required. I think that's part of what you were getting at.
Yes.
So the UIRC, the cost would go way down for the UIRC site when it is built out.
But if you built on the Washington Trust property now, what would you have to put in on that upper line currently?
I think what Chad was saying was you would still need to build out to this development area because that's where the load's needed right now. So you're either going to serve it from the UIRC or Chelan Heights site down to this location, or you're going to serve it from the Washington Federal site this direction.
What you're saying is you've got multiple sites that have need, and that's driving the need for distribution.
And I just want to point out we're focusing in on some specific locations that are associated with growth that's current. Really what we're trying to do is attach to existing distribution injection points, meaning where we already have pipes that are capable of handling the amount of capacity, and the legacy, or excuse me, that is Crystal View Estates 2. Where Crystal View Estates 2 is located, we have built bigger pipes or larger distribution underground infrastructure, so it makes a good injection point for the capacity.
Yes.
So not knowing what future growth, where that will actually occur, it might occur in Manson. And so the question I have is on the Urich property. It let's assume that future growth expands dramatically in the Manson area, and we purchased Urich not to build on but for future growth. Would that still be the optimum location that we would want to choose in order to meet the demand growth in Manson?
Optimum, I'm not sure, but definitely a site that could be planned around. So,
but if today we were faced with dealing with growth in Manson, mm-hmm. Well, is that somewhere we would be looking?
It would be one of the sites. What we would need is a substation site in between the Washington Federal and Manson. Right now is Wapato. So we want to just start, we want to continue to split the differences between the existing sites, probably a good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. So the more sites that we have available to the PUD to build infrastructure in between those existing sites. So let's say in your scenario, Manson started growing. What we would end up doing then is taking infrastructure, or taking areas that are currently fed from Manson and moving that to Wapato, and then allowing for additional capacity in Manson, and then picking up the Urich site and building distribution to that. So it really needs to be looked at as kind of a system, and the more distribution infrastructure we have, the more pipes that we have, we're able to move that capacity around and move that demand around a little bit.
Thank you.
Randy, I have comments, but I want to wait until after we hear from the folks in the audience.
Sure.
We have several people here.
You bet. You bet.
And half hour wait,
yep,
from lunchtime.
Could I make one quick comment? Just hopefully I'll do this in a minute. Commissioner Arsenault raised a really important point, I think, that we just haven't hit on yet, which is as we've moved away from the blue line, you can see we're adding a lot of transmission and distribution. As we add more transmission and distribution, I think you're aware that we've been working on this project ever since the wildfires a couple of years ago to look at risk associated with wildfires and how it impacts the transmission and distribution system. So one of the things that happens when you add T&D is you add risk. So there is more risk here associated with any of these three options than there would be associated with being closer to the blue line, as well as more O&M costs associated with the transmission and distribution system. So just something to be aware of as we're thinking this through, because wildfire risk has become a much bigger issue for us as a result of the events of the last couple of years.
In that blue line you're referring to is on the first slide, where the midpoint.
Yes,
vertical,
thank you.
The vertical blue line.
Vertical blue line, yep. Yes.
Okay. All right. I know there are several community members here from the Chelan area, and we would welcome your comments and your input. You bet. You state your name and address for the record.
Good morning. My name is Michael Gibb. I live at 610 Boyd Road, permanent citizen of, and ratepayer in the area. Good morning, Steve. Good morning, commissioners. I want to really address three areas very quickly this morning, and there are other people behind me I know that want to speak. But I have some pertinent comments about, number one, meeting the immediate need that we've been talking about this morning for the third substation and helping all of us to move forward in this next month. Number two, I want to talk a little bit about the planning for long-term need of electrical infrastructure, and I just would like to thank Chad for his comments in the last 5 minutes and the discussion we just had about the need to be proactive and get ahead of the curve. And number three, I want to address the transmission and distribution line or T&D line visual impact issues. So over the last 2 years or so, I've been a member the last year of the community focal group. It's definitely been a stop-and-go type process. And lucky staff and lucky commissioners, you're able to deal with this two times, both in Leavenworth and Chelan. My hat's off to you. But the good news is that that we've made progress, and I think that we have three sites, one of which is the best choice for us to move forward with now, and with the critical caveat of addressing the T&D line visual impact, I and many of my neighbors support as the first choice to build now the Washington Federal Savings Site above the golf course. And I and many of my neighbors have communicated directly to commissioners with emails and through opinion gathering mechanism with Tika and Megan, who've both done a wonderful job. I'm not sure, Tika, if you have the map that I sent you. Thank you. So just to recap very quickly, a few of the reasons that I should say, support the WAFED parcel is that it's the closest to the blue theoretical load line, and that is what the PUD has been asking for all along. And the load line sits right here. The WAFED site is in an undeveloped area above the golf course that doesn't have an existing neighborhood impact as far as visual noise or illumination. So right now it scores very high in aesthetics. As we've discussed this morning, it's even hidden behind a hill as far as the golfers. The Washington Fed site has developed roadway for site access, for construction, and for maintenance. And this site will serve efficiently the adjacent areas of high growth currently, such as Legacy Ridge, the Lookout, and Crystal View Estates 2. So this is the Lookout right here. Construction going huckledy-buck up on that hilltop right there. So we're familiar with Crystal View, the lower portion, Crystal View Estates, the upper portion. You'll see some pictures from me in a moment. And then Legacy Ridge, a northwest expansion of Crystal View Estates 2, is all bare ground right now. It's been developed. Infrastructure is in, ready for hammers and nails. We need to get ahead of this curve. So I want to say, first of all, that I'm against the double circuit that either the Chelan Heights Orchard where the URIC property would cause, basically in front of where I live, which is up in this area. And by a two-step process, we can avoid having to do that. And from my letters, you know that two-step process is purchasing and developing WAFED now and tying up the URIC site for the construction and development that will inevitably occur to the north, northwest, and northeast of Manson. So, my specific recommendation, I urge the commissioners to direct staff to proceed with the WAFED savings site for purchase and development. Let me move on to my second point, planning for long term. We've been told that the need for the third substation is because on the North Shore, we're at 80% capacity, and there's been a lot of relevant discussion about that this morning. Much of the staff has pointed out how we're getting down to the 11th hour. It's evident that the accelerated pace of development and construction has added to our situation of a critical need. It's time for us to be much more proactive rather than reactive in planning for and providing electrical infrastructure. With the fast-paced developments of Crystal View Estates, the Lookout, Legacy Ridge, the Reserve, the community has been forced into retrofitting a substation into the system. The Franson site was an example of potentially locating a substation into an existing residential neighborhood. It's easier to build a substation first and let a new neighborhood build up around it rather than the other way around. And one of the comments by somebody concerning the site above the golf course said that it's possibly slated for a recreational development. That's the perfect scenario. You put the substation in first, and then it's a known quantity, and a development builds up around it. Just like people who build houses with transmission lines right in front of them. They already know it's there, so you're not going to get any pushback from them. Many believe that when large developments are first proposed, and this is crucial, developers, city planners need to be involved up front, along with the PUD, with land set aside for and financed by those developers for such things as substations. We have an opportunity now to get ahead of the curve. So my recommendation is set aside now the UREC site, purchase it now for future construction after we purchase the WAFED site, and that will serve us well in the future for the inevitable construction and growth requirements in the greater Manson area. My last area that I'd like to talk about, addressing the transmission and distribution line visual impact. My support for the WAFED site comes with the critical caveat of reducing or eliminating the visual impact that distribution underbuild on transmission towers 20 feet higher than they already are would create. Chelan is known for its beautiful lake and mountain views. People have purchased homes because of those views in many cases. It is understood that transmission lines cannot go underground. But throughout this whole process, we've been told that the rule of thumb from Chelan PUD is that we match in the adjacent area whatever new distribution we put in. I want to point out that Chelan Hills neighborhood, which is really only about three rescue clubs away from the WAFED site, already has underground distribution. So it's time to go underground on the North Shore. So if I could just point out, if I get my hand to hold steady, so here's the WAFED site. You've already told us that a portion of this would go underground. So when we're teeing off, we won't be seeing more wires there. But look at the immediate neighborhoods in the area and the area that this underbuild of distribution lines would go through. It is already underground. Using your own rule of thumb, the underbuild proposed for this section of the transmission lines should not happen. Rather, we should go double underground circuit, and I have three options that I'll point out here very quickly, and then I'll be done. My specific recommendation is I'm asking the commissioners to direct the staff to explore these distribution options for distribution from WAFED to the planned Crystal View Estates insertion. So option number one, which I think is the very best option, is to construct all of the double circuit 1 and 4 directly underground, either to the Crystal View Estates 2 insertion point right here, or as you'll see in other options, to an earlier point. A couple of other options would be that right here, I'm not an engineer, but I'm wondering if the capacity here of the underground is such that right before the upper Chelan Hills area, I think the street is called, Palisade? I can't remember. I'll tell you in a minute. But perhaps there's an insertion point right here, and then the grid would be fed that way. If that can't happen, as you'll see from a picture of mine, there is right here a gully. This is the north end of the Upper Chelan Hills neighborhood, and there's a gully right here. At the base of that gully is the turn of Boyd Road, right there. And you'll see a picture that there is a portal into the underground right there. Again, I don't know if the water pipes, Chad, are big enough there to have that as an insertion point, but if the option two and option three do not work to feed this underground grid, then I am hopeful that we can all come together and have a win-win with WAFED now purchased and built on, and then go by our own rule of thumb to the insertion point with a double underground circuit. How to pay for it? Last comments, that's probably one thing on your mind. Well, using your own rule of thumb, and as ratepayers, I would say that the cost of that double underground for this win-win situation should be baked in the cake. In other words, it should be the cost of the expansion, sort of a cost of not pre-planning far enough in advance, and it, therefore having to go more rural. Or, John and I have discussed possible LID, local improvement district approach. And if we did an LID, I would suggest that all these people and developers would be a part of that LID and share those significant costs.
Yeah, Mr. Gibbs, I need to ask you to really speed up. You've been on about 15 minutes now. So,
and I am almost done, sir. The third option, perhaps, for financing this would be a rate surcharge for those on the North Shore to distribute cost over the entire, and that would be a finite surcharge for a certain period of time to pay for that extra underground. Could I just go to the next picture? So this is a view of Crystal View Estates. Two, off to the right, you'll on the next picture, you'll see in the far distance, the snow-covered area is Legacy Ridge, next picture. And all of that white down there, this is from up on Henderson Road, all that white before the lake is land that is ready to go for building houses. Next picture. Again, Legacy Ridge. This is from down at Crystal View Estates near where the insertion would be. You see the transmission lines coming down the easement from the Henderson Road area. That would be an area that we want to come down underground. Next picture. This type of thing that many people live with now, but that's a given. We don't want to add the infrastructure, the underbuild to those poles. Next picture. So Pinnacle Place is the portion of the Upper Chelan hills that I'm talking about. Next picture. There is a possible insertion site on the south end underneath the existing transmission lines. Next picture. This tree marks the spot. You'll see on the north end of that same road, transmission lines. Next picture. And then if you look from there down, that's Boyd Road that swings across there. Next picture. And there is at the bottom of that, right on Boyd Road, the transmission lines are at the top of the picture, and that's a possible insertion point there. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Quick question, because we are really short on time. Michael, would you say that your recommendation of using the Washington purchasing Washington Federal property and the UWIC property and beginning starting with the substation location at Washington Federal property, would you say that is the recommendation of the community focus group? Or is that your recommendation and a few neighbors?
I cannot say that it's the recommendation of the focus group. We haven't had any meetings for a long time. But it is definitely the majority opinion of the 18 or 20 families that I'm in discussions with up and down the Boyd Henderson Road, with some exceptions, definitely.
That's something I, as one commissioner, would like to see. I would love to see the group get together again and bring forth a recommendation that the group can agree on. Thank you. Thanks for your work.
Hi, my name is Corky Thorson, and Robin Vogel, and I own a property up on 63 Balsam. It's just off Henderson Road. And I'd like to present a couple of pictures, if you can pass those on to the commissioners. A picture of our house looking out toward the lake and the back picture of our house. Well, Michael was the good cop. I'm going to be the bad cop. So we'll do it in a humorous way, but I think some things really need to be addressed here that haven't been addressed in the past concerning the North Shore substation and the addition of the proposed distribution and transmission lines. few days after the February 22nd meeting, which I wasn't aware of, Michael Gibb passed a lot of information on to the rest of us up on Henderson Road and Henderson Terrace and Boyd Loop Road concerning what was to take place at the meeting that would impact all of us living in those areas. He said that another of our neighbors, Carl Glossinger, had asked a question concerning power lines, regardless of which substation site were to be chosen. And the answer he got was that new power poles crossing our view of Lake Chelan and our neighbors also would be 20 to 30 feet higher, and additional six distribution lines would be added to those power poles. When you look in those pictures as you pass them around, you'll see there's three transmission lines in the lower part, which is at the bottom part of our view of Lake Chelan. So it doesn't really come into view. We've gotten used to it. When I purchased the property 27 years ago, I walked it, 7 acres, quiet, serene. View was just outstanding. That's what sold me on it. I looked at the transmission lines, wasn't happy about it, but the status quo was there. I said, I can live with that. I can live with that. So now we cut to the chase here. PUD, I think, in my estimation, has failed to plan ahead. Now their capacity and time frame problem is put on us, compromising our views and our property values. And to us, this is not an option. It's not negotiable. I think the idea the commissioner mentioned about the wildland fires undergrounding, I think it's an outstanding idea. I worked 33 years as an urban firefighter and a paramedic, and I worked 3 summers doing wildland firefighting, 2 of which were rappelling from helicopters around the Chelan area. I think the existing owners are now directed to take on higher poles and up to 6 additional lines in the middle of our view to benefit Crystal View, Lookout, and Legacy for their power needs. And they're the cause for this increased power consumption. I understand that. Growth is inevitable. But we also found out that we would bear the brunt as personal homeowners of the undergrounding costs across our property. I don't think that's right. I think it should be borne by everyone who benefits from this increased power capacity. If it takes the LID process, as Michael mentioned, then so be it. For an increased rate, enhanced rate, be more than happy to pay that. I think the commissioners have a moral obligation to come see firsthand the view on our properties, and we welcome them there anytime. Come on up. We'll make time for you, and because we live in Kirkland, I came over this morning, got up at 4:30 to drive over here, and this is too important not to attend. You'll see what we saw, what I saw 27 years ago. I've had people come up and work on the property that live in Chelan, and they just go, wow, this is incredible. So I want to make sure that today the PUD hears us, because we've heard this before, that they hear us. We hear us. You're going to respond to it. But we wouldn't have found out about these lines if Carl Glossinger hadn't asked the question in the February 22nd meeting. I don't know when it was going to be addressed, when it was going to be made known to us. So we have kind of a lack of confidence in PUD as far as them doing what they intend to do in regard to taking care of our concerns in regard to our views. I mean, that's why we purchased over here. I mean, I love the valley, but the view is just outstanding, like I said. One other thing, it made me pretty angry that as a result of that February 22nd meeting, one of our neighbors came home, and he has a beautiful view home, and he told his wife, we're going to sell. I've had it. And that is wrong, friends. That's absolutely wrong. So I want to be sympathetic to PUD's growing capacity problem, but I don't think taller utility poles, more lines, in our view, is the way to accomplish that. I think it's a plan from the 50s and 60s. I think it's time to step up and have a vision for the future and what we want. I think the Chelan Valley, especially looking out toward the lake, is one of the most beautiful view corridors you're ever going to see. And they're going to be up for 40 to 50 years, those lines. So let's give it a lot of thought before we do it. So I challenge PUD to rethink their position on overhead lines and come up with a way to underground these lines instead. It's been done all over the state, so it's not totally cost prohibitive. We have the most beautiful corridor, like I said, in the state, with the cheapest electric rates in the country. And I don't think PUD has the right to boast about those cheap rates at the expense of negatively impacting our views at this point in time. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Clint.
I have the unenviable
Could I job. Get you to introduce yourself?
I'm Clint Campbell here, 156 Grandview Lane in Chelan.
Okay.
The enviable position of taking the just before lunch last presentation and also take a NIMBY position. But here I am, so I guess I'll just go ahead and launch. I sent Commissioner Congdon a letter highlighting some information that I wanted to share with you about the Washington Federal site, mostly as it relates to property that we own immediately next to it. We are hip deep in some planning for real estate development that we think, first of all, if I can kind of show, and correct me if I've got these in the right spot, the Washington Fed substation site would be about here, got that right, and then the transmission line that would connect to the existing transmission line would run somewhere here.
Yes, the Washington Federal site would be directly above the left-hand side of your triangle there.
And then these are the existing transmission lines. So I wanted to point out to the commissioners that we own this property that is next to the Washington Fed site, have owned it for decades, and wanted to put it to its highest and best use. We think this is probably the most valuable tourism recreation property within the city of Chelan. There isn't very much of this stuff in the city of Chelan. Here we have this tremendous Lake Chelan amenity, the municipal golf course, which is an enormous draw. We have secured tourist accommodation zoning for all this property here and down below. And I think it would be just remiss for us not to share with you that we have these plans and these and this very unique, I think very unique, special, and rare convergence of situational property with TA zone, golf course, and we know that there'll be impacts from any substation in this area. For one, of course, we're already encumbered by a transmission line that skirts our property that borders the golf course. So that's kind of a bummer. That's the way it is, and that's the way it's been. It looks like we will get another transmission line here that's going to definitely impact the views of this butte here towards the lake and towards the west. They'll, if I understand it correctly, obviously there'll be a good size easement for the underground here that's probably going to border our golf course proximity property, as well as, am I right about this, probably underground somewhere here, also with the necessary easements. Do I have that? Is that correct?
Yeah, it's just right along your property line and the municipal golf course property line.
So I just thought it was important for us to share with you that we could possibly have this plan have some greatly reduced and diminished value because of this project. Nobody likes to take a NIMBY attitude. We certainly appreciate the fact that the PUD is looking ahead and wants to keep the lights on for us. But we also know that there's all kinds of criteria that you're using to make these decisions with regard to which site to pick. And I thought we'd be remiss if we didn't share our plans with you and what we feel some of the immediate impacts are going to be, and to suggest this could be some real economic hardship for us. So appreciate you allowing me to visit with you, and if you have any questions. I do have one question regarding the WAFED site. It's my understanding that the real estate development never perfected their access to Union Valley, and maybe you know that they have, but that is still blocked off, and it was one of the reasons that, if I understand it correctly, that development never came through. None of the eastern end of their property was able to put the infrastructure in because they didn't have access to Union Valley. The original developers put it in the wrong spot. They didn't have the site clearance to connect to Union Valley. Now they have this engineering and cost nightmare to try to tie into Union Valley. And I just wonder, had you solved that problem, and was that a part of the cost estimate of choosing that site? So thank you.
Thank you.
I have a quick question.
Clinton, wait.
Can you bring your map back, Clint, please?
Just put it
up there. I have a question for you. I can't really see the color code in the upper left-hand corner. So can you point out where your property is that you're interested in developing? Would that be the blue sections?
It's everything. It's
Where's the existing golf course?
Right here.
Right there.
Right.
So the blue, the green, the...
All this is zone TA. This is the stuff that is immediately
impacted.
Next to the WAFED property and this here.
So where exactly would, with Andrew's help, where exactly would that would the substation go relative to that map?
About here. I got clarified from Gary called me, Gary Rice. Thank you, Gary. We initially thought from the Chelan meeting that these transmission lines connecting to the existing transmission lines that are going to connect to the substation, we're going to go right across this property. Apparently, they're going to skirt the property to the west and tie in. And so that's a good thing because this property is already encumbered by transmission lines. Having them bisected again would really devalue it. One thing, this boundary here along the golf course on our property, apparently in the plan is slated to be underground. But it's my understanding that isn't cast in stone. That could go above ground because of cost. No,
wouldn't go above ground.
Cast in stone.
Well, the route could change.
The
underground component would not change.
Okay. And so just important, you know, just important for the commissioners to know a little bit more about the surrounding property here. And that it really is kind of the unique and last amazing recreational piece, tourist accommodation zone inside the city limits of Chelan.
Thank you. Thank you. And just to let people know, we will continue till we'll postpone our lunch hour until we get all the testimony. So,
we appreciate that. My name is Jerry Boyce. I live at 71 Boyd Loop Road. So the first point that you would be accessing the Chelan Heights Orchard site, if you chose that, would be my property, which you would need to get across about a quarter mile of it.
Want to get that into out it here? Just hit that red button, laser.
And you can...
That red button right in the middle.
There you go.
So that piece right there is all me. You would end up coming in right there. Like Michael says, it's hard to hold this thing. Yeah, you would end up coming down across that property there, which is mine, and then you would end up getting on to the Schmelzer site, which is the person that's offered to sell you the property. Right now, that easement road was set up for them to get access to these four pieces of land right up here, the future building sites, and that's all that easement was set up for. My concern is that place of that location is right on the knoll of a hill. You're about 150 to 200 yards directly straight across
would be my view of the lake and would be the substation sitting right out there. So you would pretty much wipe out my property values. My neighbor who couldn't be here, he had recent hip surgery. He's building a winery. He's already planted the grapes, putting in a tasting room and living quarters. That, if we go with that, you're going to totally go. That was our concerns. All of our neighbors up in that area are the same opinion. You're looking down on a substation that's the lights are on 24 hours a day. It's got tall poles around it. You've wiped out everything that we paid a lot of money for. So my suggestion is to go with the Washington Fed site, buy the Ulrich for future, and be smart about it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Robin Vogel. We have a vacation home at 63 Balsam Drive in Chelan. My husband, Corky Thorson, already spoke. I'll make this really brief. I'll make it really simple. I'm angry right now. I'm really angry. A couple points I want to just reiterate that were said here. Number one, I think you've heard from the gentleman who spoke about the recreational area. You've heard from other owners in writing and here today. I think you guys need to figure out a way to underground these distribution lines so that our views are not impacted, our property values are not impacted. And if you think you're getting pushback now, wait till people are paying $2 and $3 million for properties at Lake Chelan and you need another substation 10 years from now, 20 years from now, whatever. And secondly, these pictures over here, hopefully I'm being recorded, this and this and this, it's not negotiable. Those are not going across my property, decimating my lake view. Thank you. And I hope you heard that.
My name's Don Summers, and my wife and I are building our future home on 319 High Point Lane, and that's in Chelan Hills. We're directly below our neighbors that you've heard from. We'll be directly impacted by the proposed substation and or the high transmission lines. Unfortunately, we were out of town during the Chelan meeting, so we wanted to come here today to offer our support for our neighbors and also address some concerns that we have, give you our opinion. After rereading all the proposals for the substation attachments, and we truly believe that the Washington Federal Savings Parcel would be in the best interest of the community. Although it may be the least expensive location, it does, however, offer the least negative impact on the existing home. Everyone in the area of Chelan Heights and Chelan Hills purchased their homes at a higher price than those in other areas, and we did so that we might enjoy the beautiful view of Lake Chelan and the neighborhood. It does not seem reasonable to expect those individuals to accept a reduction in their home values and the loss of an unobstructed view of Lake Chelan when other locations are available that may offer little or no impact on existing homes. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. Good to see you all. I was kind of hoping I didn't have to see you for a little while longer, but I've been tracking. My husband.
Could I get
your name and address? Oh, I'm sorry. Carolyn Lassinger, 490 Boyd Road. And my husband is the one who came home from the February 22nd meeting saying, that's it, we're selling. No to those lines. He's been living with the three from the moment we purchased it. The idea of nine or more or whatever, he's like, no way. We went to a winery called Melisone. Walked out on their deck, and bam, that's where those lines were, right in your view. And he said, we would never buy a place that's going to have that view. Guess what's going to happen? So anyway, that's where he's at, and I can only go along with him. We love our home. We put a wine room in it. That was my Christmas gift from him. Love it. And thank you for hearing my emails asking for pictures and for cost analysis. I appreciate it. But this is the picture. These pictures are the pictures I fear. And he will not stay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional public testimony? You wanted to say something?
I think Gary wanted to go first, and then I'm going to add on to Gary.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
Thank you.
I wanted to start off by saying that thank you for all the feedback that we've heard today and also through the emails that we've received. And I have great sympathy. No one wants to have view disruption. The difficult spot that we are in, or that I am in as a commissioner, is I'm looking at a $3 million additional cost. And I'm saying, how do I deal with a $3 million additional cost when I'm going to be asked that question from people in ENIAT that is saying, you spent $3 million and I'm in ENIAT, I get no benefit from that. Or I'm in Malaga and I get no benefit from that. And if Chelan PUD has to raise rates at some point in the future because we've taken on and spent additional dollars, how do I justify that? I'm pleased to hear today Mr. Gibb and Mr. Thorson suggest that an LID or a rate surcharge. My only question is, do other residents affected by a rate surcharge in the area, do they feel the same way? And so maybe what we need to do is include a little bit of outreach to the other residents whose view isn't disrupted by power lines or a substation that live in this area, and see if they're willing to absorb that LID cost. And I would certainly be a lot warmer to the concept of spending an extra $3 million if that was possible. But one of the things that I was charged with as a commissioner when I became a commissioner was to keep costs down. And so I'm looking for a way that we can make this a win-win situation. So I applaud your comments. I applaud your suggestions. And you've given us something, some new food for thought that we can certainly look into.
Well, so I kind of sat up tall in my chair when you said maybe we should do some more outreach. Corky, to your comment, we've been listening and doing outreach for 18 months. We're not the PUD we used to be. Most of you know, Michael and those of you on the focus group know, we used to go out, select a piece of property that we thought was the best piece of property, put an option on it, and then we would go out to the community and say, what do you think? We don't do things that way anymore. We go out to you first. I think that's a good process. It's costing more money because of that. It's taking more time because of that, but I think that's the right thing to do. We are a different PUD in that we're now customer-focused. So we have been listening. We've read every comment that's come to us. We've had multiple meetings. We've had tons of analysis done. We've had the community focus group do their analysis. They've done their spreadsheet. The time is here for a decision. We've gone out and knocked on doors and tried to find property that where we have willing sellers. And that's not been easy. There was a time when we only had one option. We now have three options. None of them are suitable to everybody. But the time has come where we have to make a decision. I'd like to see a decision by the end of March. I don't think we can do a lot more research. I mean, a lot more outreach. We can't really do any more outreach. What I would like to see, though, from Michael, from your community focus group, is see if you guys can gel and come forward with a recommendation. And then I think it's time for us to make a decision. And they're going to be those of you who are not happy. There are people who say you just need to look at that vertical load center and then from that consider that and do the least cost option. My feeling is that's one factor we consider. But let's hear from the community group and then we have to make a decision.
Any other comments? So you're not asking for any decision today, but going forward. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
We will be back in 2 weeks, yes, on both of these projects, on both Chelan and Leavenworth.
Okay. All right.
Thank you all for coming, though.
We really do
appreciate your time and understand this is really difficult.
It is difficult. So let's recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock or very shortly thereafter.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Good afternoon. This is March 6, 2017. We met this morning in a study session and are reconvening this afternoon for our business session. But this morning we left three items on the study session unfinished, and we'll plan is to pick those three items up first and move forward with our agenda. But one item has been brought to my attention that we have one resolution that is a great candidate for consent agenda, if that meets with the agreement with my fellow commissioners. Okay, so yes. Item 10 will get moved to the consent agenda. All right, so back to item 5, Otobash and Recreation Area.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Jeff Osborne, License Compliance Supervisor. Wanted to give you an update today on where we are with the Otobash and Natural Area property. Up and down arrows for change? Okay. I'm kind of technologically challenged, so.
You and me both.
Yes. So today I just wanted to have three main points. This acquisition and processing of this property is going to require a filing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which you probably already know. Then give you some options that were proposed, the exact same boards that were used for the open houses on February 15th and 16th. And then, obviously, have the envelope with the name and the winner is, and so we'll go with that at the end. Okay. So as you see here, this is the property, and see if I can get my arrow to work here. The orange highlighted area here with the cursor is the area that we purchased from Washington Department of Transportation, and that is the... And with a little bit of added with the blue line, it's pretty much going to be all of the property that is waterward of the existing loop trail. So that is one component. The other is you see two areas here in yellow hatching. Those are currently within the Rock Island project boundary, but those are properties that are in surplus in excess of project needs. So we are proposing to remove those from the project boundary. So that you are probably more than aware of the ports of Douglas County's proposals and Douglas County of what they're looking at in that property, the north of the bridge. We want to make sure that we're not doing anything in conflict with their master plan. So modify the project boundary from this green line, which incorporates the yellow properties, to the red line. So it will still encompass all of the properties that we've acquired, but remove the two yellow hatch sections. So those are the three components. Include this, remove these two pieces of property, redo the project boundary for Rock Island. So that will be the major components of the filing to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Okay. So the options that were proposed at the open houses, you can see, you know, minimal enhancements, but a trail, this is option A, but it has a trailhead up in the northern area, as well as somewhere in the middle, and providing crushed gravel, compacted gravel trail to this area, adding a restroom and then receptacles for trash and things like that. So this is one of the two options that were presented at the open houses. And the other looks very, very much the same, other than the trail from the northern area is not proposed. So the response that we got from the open houses was overwhelming support for acquiring the property and keeping it in its natural state in perpetuity. So that was fantastic. The opinions were kind of split between the minimalistic trail enhancements versus the one from the north. So it was kind of, know, some 50-50 there, but everyone was very, very supportive of acquiring their property and keeping it in its natural state, limiting the recreation and trying to focus that recreation to the area that is being proposed here. And so then the team, as well as some very important input from the senior team, analyzed the information from our polls and from open houses and worked through some very varying criteria about name that has something to do with the cultural resource and the natural area. And so the recommendation is for Coyote or Coyote, depending on which way you like to do it. I'm a Coyote person. Dunes Natural Area was the recommendation to the board.
I like it.
A lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my understanding at this point is to
So Commissioners, Eric Walkless, General Counsel. So I don't think that if the board is so inclined to have it formally named that a resolution is necessary. No action is technically necessary, and that's how we can refer to it. But if the board is so inclined, probably a motion setting that name would be appropriate.
I will move to formally adopt the recommended or the proposed name, Coyote Dunes Natural Area, for the Otobeshan property.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded that we officially name the natural recreation area that we've just been talking about, Coyote Dunes Natural Area. I just need to say it's got to be coyote, not coyote. So that
potato, potato. I'll leave that up to the speakers. So, I'll try not to add my bias.
Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. So the schedule, we'll still have to work on the schedule a little bit and probably provide an update potentially at a later date. But we're trying to get maybe all of this wrapped up early to mid-summer to get that filing into the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Then it's usually 6 to 9 months is the normal time frame in which the commission will send a order back to us. However, we're kind of hoping that it may be sooner than that because we've been talking with them a lot about this over the last year, year and a half. So we're hoping that maybe that might speed their response to us.
Make sure you pass on our thanks to all the folks that worked hard at this whole process because we really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a good team effort.
Jeff, what about option A and option B? Will you make that decision?
Those that we're going to have the same team, obviously have some discussions with the senior team as well. Part of the component there is we need to make sure that we're not, we need to do some cultural surveys and research in that area so that we're not putting a trail through a potential cultural location. So that may dictate to us what we can and can't do. So we still need to have some research done there.
So probably the ribbon cutting will be this summer?
Would you like to do it when we file or when we receive the order? That.
So, both, yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
All right.
Exciting.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff. Oh, and thanks for waiting all morning long.
That was quite an interesting discussion this morning.
Yeah. Thank you for being patient with my, my Chelan folks who have no problem stating their opinions on issues, right?
Right. Right. All right. District Financial Policies Update.
I'll take one moment just to introduce this to remind you that last year we presented a fair amount of work on the long-term debt philosophy, which really got to more than just debt. It was an overall, where are we going with our financials, scenarios where we looked at the expected case and then scenarios where we looked at what happens if things go wrong. We got higher costs and lower revenues. And what we concluded from that is that we should always be prepared for that worst-case scenario. And that in the worst-case scenario, we would be looking at borrowing earlier or looking at rate increases earlier. And we should be prepared at least for that. Mm-hmm. And so this is a part of that work. Going back and starting, we have a series of things we'll be bringing forward over the course of the year that look at financial policies and begin to think about the issues that we would need to address in order to make changes in rates. Even if we tried to start now, it would take us a couple of years probably to put something in place. So this is part of that contingency planning work to review this, and it's also just a really good time because we are in a really different place from when the financial policies were adopted a few years ago. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark and Heather.
Good afternoon. I'm Heather Ireland, lead treasury analyst for the district, and with me today is Mark O'Brien, director of strategic financial planning. Thanks for the background, Steve. That's really helpful as we kind of start discussing why we're talking about district-wide financial policies now. We've had a group working for a while in the district on refining and reviewing the district-wide financial policies. And as Steve mentioned, this really grew out of some work that we had done last year in recognizing that there's a lot of interrelated decisions that go on at the district. And having that good continual financial planning helps in that district decision making. So today what we'll be talking about is starting with the 2017 district performance plan goal that talks a little bit about what the finance department's plans are for the year in regards to financial strategies. Also wanted to talk just briefly about financial policy history and our current status of where we're at. Our team does have some recommendations for refinements to district-wide financial policies and processes, and so we'll talk about those today, introduce those ideas. Also going to be presenting some forecast metrics of what those changes might mean on a regular basis and where we're at today with those forecasts, and then summary and go over next steps of where we'll be at. Today is just information only, no actions being requested at this time. And in addition to the presentation pages, at the end of the presentation, there is an appendix that has some additional information about each financial metric, how it's calculated, some background on why we view it as an important item for the district to be tracking. So you can refer to that if you'd like to, but I won't be covering that in today's presentation. To start with, talking about 2017 district performance plan, there is a goal in the performance plan in support of Objective 4, which is ensuring financial stability, to conduct a series of financial strategy sessions this year. And those are kind of that outgrowth of last year's work, long-term debt philosophy, some work done on the HDL rates, just kind of recognition that there are a lot of interrelated topics, and focusing and doing some review and some work this year will help, again, put us in good place into the future for financial planning. This is the first in that series. This is anticipated to be the first presentation in that series this year. And really what we're looking at is a series of sessions to adjust and affirm long-term financial policies, to establish integrated electric business line financial policies, to discuss rate philosophies and power contract guidelines, as well as cost of service analysis guidelines and internal debt funding philosophies. So right now we're targeting Q1. To complete a review and refresh of those district-wide financial policies. And then next quarter, coming back with a review and a refresh of business line financial policies, including establishing an integrated electric financial policy. And then later in this year, looking at long-term rate guidance and also long-term internal and external debt guidelines. Some of the key messages of today's presentation. Again, obviously, we'll be talking about review and refinement of the district's financial policies. But really, some key takeaways is that the district has very stable finances at this time, and those increase our flexibility. Being in a good position to respond to challenges as they arise really keep our options open. That's been something that I think has been seen over the last year or two, particularly with our long-lived assets, our hydro facilities. There's been a lot of opportunity to make decisions around how do we invest, when do we invest, what are the right times, and really a lot of that ability, that flexibility comes from having stable finances, so we do have decision-making options. Strong financial policies help support a solid AA credit rating, and that's something that also gives the district flexibility, helps preserve access to financial markets if that's something we need, helps give us options with power sales counterparties. Our high credit rating is something that's attractive for people to do business with. You'll also note in the presentation today that we have continued stability in our financial metrics in recent years, and those improvements have actually positioned us well ahead of our peers. There was a time not so long ago when the district had a financial condition that was not quite as good as our peers, and we were trailing behind a little bit, but a lot of decisions have been put in place to put us in a much more solid position going forward. And that stability helps us take a moment now and look at broadening our financial targets and review processes to see what can we do in the future to help continue keep those in a stable position. A little bit of background on financial policies themselves. Really, the whole financial policy process really is a continuous cycle. Years ago, we established financial policies. We then go through a period of seeing how those are working, evaluating if they're producing the results we want and working the way we want them to. And then we do a refinement, realign them to our mission, vision, and strategic plan, taking into consideration customer preferences, and then resetting the whole cycle in motion again. The original financial policies that our current financial policies are based on were put in place in 2010. A real period of change for the district as we went into new power sales contracts. We had had contracts in place for 30 and 50 years. As those transitioned, we were in a very different situation. And so establishing those financial policies in 2010 really allowed us to move forward with really a new financial vision for the district. In 2014, those were evaluated and extended into the policies that we're currently operating under, which cover the period of 2015 through 2019. We're now in 2017, and we could wait for a few more years to evaluate those policies, but this is really a good time to look at, do we want to extend them beyond 2019? Are we in the position now with stable finances that we can look to a longer, more durable financial policy structure? In addition, in 2015, there were business line policies established for water, wastewater, and the fiber system. And in 2017, we're planning on reviewing those as well. That will be the next step in our envision process for the strategy sessions at the board level. In addition to developing an integrated electric policy, the current integrated electric financial policies are more keyed off the district-wide policies. But we're suggesting looking at, would a dedicated integrated electric business line policy serve the district well? So that will be later in 2017. But right now, we're looking at the district-wide policies, and we're recommending that now is the time to look at extending those. As we do a review, there's some guiding principles. These are very similar to those used in prior financial policy updates, including 2010 and 2014. Some of the key things that our team looked at were the district's desire to maintain a strong AA credit rating, again, access to financial markets, low-cost borrowing, attractive relationships with counterparties. All of those things come from a AA credit rating, and one of our guiding principles was to continue to maintain that. The other guiding principle we really looked at was encompassing a number of different goals to create a sustainable long-term plan, which would inform cohesive decision-making at the district. Those things that would help, what we felt would help promote that, would be transparency and achieving strategic objectives, having accountability to our customer owners, and also recognizing customer satisfaction. One of those key components that customers have expressed as a preference is long-term rate predictability, and having financial policies that promote that is a goal in our process. We also looked at promoting operational excellence and fiscal health, and part of that also supports the uninterrupted access to financial markets at the lowest reasonable cost. We looked at considering prudent allocation and recovery of capital costs over time, which allows us to maintain our long-lived value-added assets and also ensure we have financial resources that are available to support responsible stewardship of the environment and the assets that have been entrusted to us. And in addition, proactive risk management, making sure that we're able to respond and have plans in place before they're necessary. From those guiding principles, we looked at where we currently are today in benchmarking the district's results for 2016 to 2015 peer medians. 2015 is the most recent period that we have data available for. As we look at our results. Our results are in line or are in line or better than our highly rated other highly rated peers. They're also in line or better than rating agency expectations for a strong AA credit. Those financial policies that we've had in place have helped us achieve those results, and we're recommending to continue strong financial policies to help sustain that into the future. One thing that I do want to note in our results, you can see that debt leverage is better than the median at 43% for the district. Peer median is currently at 48% in 2015. That's a big improvement for the district. Over the years, we've actually been on the higher end of that rating agency expectation or in excess of that. In 2010, when we started our new financial path, we've made a lot of progress to bring that down. So that's good. It's one of the first years we've actually been ahead of those peer medians. Another area I wanted to note was the noted financial liquidity is very strong at 518 days. One of the reasons that that's so important for the district to have a high level of financial liquidity has been in the past to support some of the other lower rated, results under the rating agency metrics. We're much more in line on our other financial metrics, but those are only a component of what rating agencies consider when they do rating reviews. There are actually a number of other things that they take into consideration that the district has less control over. So it's important to have a high liquidity balance to help supplement some of that. In addition, strong liquidity has really supported future large expense, supported paying for future large expenses as the district continues to try and minimize its debt balances and continues along the path of debt reductions. That liquidity helps us make debt payments as well as fund capital from cash rather than borrowing new debt. It is anticipated that those amounts will decline in the future as we enter a more of a, rather than a debt reduction mode, more of a debt stability mode. And that would be reasonable if we weren't continuing to pay for as much capital out of our cash balances. When we look at our benchmarking, that leads us to some conclusions from our teamwork on the recommendations for financial policies. Three metrics we actually don't have any recommended changes on. We believe that the existing policies are meeting the district's needs well and helping us to continue that financial stability. The no changes are recommended to debt service coverage, which is currently targeted at 2x debt service coverage or greater. Debt leverage, which is currently targeted at less than 35% in 2019. And then also financial liquidity, which is currently targeted at greater than $175 million of financial liquidity or the financial methodology calculation, whichever is higher. And the team really feels that those are currently serving the district well and that continuing those into the future indefinitely would be a good thing. We do have a few recommendations for changes, the first being on the unrestricted cash target. The district current financial policies requires us to target maintaining greater than $150 million of unrestricted cash. That's in addition to our financial liquidity target. We are recommending rather than using a fixed dollar amount for unrestricted cash, we transition to a day's cash on hand metric. And we would suggest that that would be greater than 250 days cash on hand. There's a couple benefits to doing that that I wanted to discuss. One of those is that the day's cash on hand target is self-adjusting, similar to our financial liquidity metric. As the way that the day's cash on hand calculation works is it looks at a comparison of your operating expenses with your unrestricted cash balances. And as your operating expenses increase, your required unrestricted cash would also increase to meet that same 250 days cash on hand requirement. If your operating expenses decrease, your required amount of unrestricted cash would also decrease to meet that same 250 days cash on hand metric. The team really likes the idea of self-adjusting metrics because as things go on through time, you don't have to go back and reevaluate should I change that fixed dollar amount? You'd still want to reevaluate whether or not it's the right metric, but you wouldn't have to look at whether that fixed dollar amount is still the right number. The financial liquidity metric has a component that self-adjusts already because it looks at the greater of $175 million or the liquidity methodology calculation. That liquidity methodology calculation is already adjusting for if we have increased risks or if we have changed risks. It's taking those into consideration. So that metric self-adjusts. The day's cash on hand metric, in addition to be self-adjusting, is also commonly used and comparable across industries. It makes benchmarking a lot easier. It makes comparing ourselves to peers within our industry as well as outside much easier. It also is a rating agency standard evaluation. It's something that all of our rating agencies look at. So it's something that is easier to tell how are we doing in their eyes. Are we still supporting that strong AA rating? Another benefit that the team saw for changing to the day's cash on hand metric was improving the clarity between the cash metrics. Right now, we have the financial liquidity target of greater than $175 million or the calculated methodology plus greater than $150 million of unrestricted cash. We felt actually separating those out and having the separate days cash on hand metric would be more clear that there are two separate metrics and it wouldn't be quite as convoluted that there's two different numbers and they're measuring two different things. So those were some of the benefits that we saw in recommending a day's cash on hand metric. The other change that the team's recommending at this time is that the rate of return target sunset after 2019. And the reasons for that is really that on a district-wide basis, the rate of return target has served its purpose very well. It has been a good support of bottom-line results, which have been reapplied to debt reduction and paying for capital as we go with cash funding. And we are proposing keeping that through 2019 as we continue the planned debt reduction strategy. But after that time, it will be more of a maintenance mode. Once we meet our targets of that lower level of debt leverage, we also feel that shifting the focus to a business line strategy and having an integrated electric business line measure of income statement results would be a better way to focus decision making and really look at the components that go into those business line metrics and have more impact in decision making at the business line level rather than at the district wide level. We think sunsetting in 2019 allows the district and the board plenty of time to consider an integrated electric financial policies that would incorporate an income statement measure of health. We're proposing to do that in 2017, later this year, but allowing the current rate of return target to sunset after 2019 is what the group would recommend. So I wanted to go ahead and provide a recap of those. On the slide, which would identify each metric, financial liquidity, unrestricted cash, which we're currently recommending replacing, also days cash on hand, debt leverage, debt service coverage, and rate of return, and a side-by-side comparison of what the current targets are and what the team would be recommending for targets in 2017 and beyond. One thing I wanted to note on the day's cash on hand metric as well is right now, $150 million of unrestricted cash does equate really well to 250 days cash on hand. They're right on top of each other right now and probably for the next few years. As we go through time, again, if there's an increase in operating expenses, that $150 million would probably gradually increase to result in the same 250 days cash on hand. But right now, they're just right on top of each other. Another set of recommendations that the team is making is some changes to the actual financial policy process. Right now, how the last few turns of financial policies have occurred is the board has established a 5-year window for financial policies, and then the district has waited for about 5 years, sometimes 4 years, and then done an evaluation. How are these doing? Are we on track? What does our new normal look like for the next 5 years? And then adopting a new set of 5-year metrics. What we're actually recommending at this time is the district has really entered this more of stable maintenance mode of our financial condition. We're actually recommending that there would be a biennial review of the financial policies, but that the financial policies wouldn't have an end date. So rather than establishing a five-year window for financial policies and then doing a really deep dive into them every 4 to 5 years, we're recommending that there would be a more frequent review, but the anticipated result of that would probably be more stability. Probably not projecting a lot of changes every couple of years. We believe that the financial policies that we're recommending at this time should be very durable for the district going forward. And then if there were any recommended changes as a result of that biennial review, they would be brought to the board for their consideration. And they could be adopted at that time if there were any changes or refinements to be made, but that the policies themselves would actually be open-ended rather than having a defined end date. That's one recommended change the team's proposing at this point for the financial policies. Another recommended change is really a refinement in the definition of the expected and unusual forecast scenarios that are included in the financial policies themselves. One is just a clarification that the probabilistic net wholesale sales revenues inform the scenarios. Currently, there is language in the resolution that talks about a probabilistic scenario incorporated at the expected and unusual forecast. And we're just proposing a clarification that that's probabilistic specific to net wholesale sales. The other area that we're recommending a modification on is that the unusual case scenario currently speaks to it being a 5% probabilistic look that's an annual impact. And at this point, we're recommending that it would be a 10% accumulated impact. So rather than the scenario looking at one single year of a downside scenario, it would actually look at a 5-year accumulated downside scenario. The team, a couple of considerations for the team was that the accumulated impact in the 5-year period would be more representative of a fundamental shift in wholesale prices rather than just a 1-year isolated incidence. We also thought that it would produce a conservative downside projection because net wholesale sales are the primary variant in that unusual case. It kind of allows us to encompass more of a broad outcome because there are not other considerations going into that unusual case scenario. On the flip side, though, it does produce lower unusual forecast results, and the primary metric that it impacts is liquidity. It doesn't have a substantial impact on debt service coverage or liquidity, or leverage, debt leverage, because debt leverage is a pretty big number, so it's pretty hard to move. And debt service coverage is really an annual look. It's really an income statement impact, not an accumulation of balance sheet impact. So it does have a little bit more of an impact on liquidity in that period. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Mark to discuss a little bit more about those impacts and the actual metric results too.
Great. Thanks, Heather. I'd start out by just acknowledging Heather. She has kind of coordinated this effort to date. I would note that this is kind of a cross-functional team from representatives from the operations as well as finance. So she's done a great job bringing us all together and getting to this point. So I'm here really to just to kind of walk through, okay, what if we applied these metrics today? How does that look? How do our current financials look associated with these changes or recommendations in these financial policies? So with that, I'll jump right in. The first item here is liquidity, and these next few graphs will look at a 5-year window. Again, these financial policies are targeting review over the 5-year horizon, so that which would roll each year but stay at the 5-year look. Again, this is just summarizing the targeted recommendation, which remains unchanged at 175, or the calculated amount. That's the top line. The expected case, that's the 50% probability. You can see those results currently are at 396. That was at year end in 2016. Those liquidity numbers do come down, actually, to 225. We do have cash reserves. We're not and the expected case, forecasting to issue any additional debt under the base case scenario. And as you can see, we're in excess of the targeted amount, which at this point in time is calculated at $199 million. So that's one of those exceptions where the calculation actually is higher than the base $175. And that's primarily driven by the fact that we haven't really hedged our position out in the fifth year to any great extent. So there's a lot more volatility, which drives that calculation a little higher to make sure we have the appropriate reserves. Looking at the downside or the unusual case, again, this is a the major change here is looking at a 10% versus the 5%. But it also compounds that and looks at that in an accumulated fashion, again, associated with a potential downside shift in market prices, which is the key driver in this downside scenario. In that scenario, you can see that the cash drops faster. Again, as we accumulate those impacts year after year, we'd have lower revenues from that wholesale market. Actually, in that 2021, we would actually be issuing $18 million of debt in order to maintain liquidity at that 203 level. Again, that's basically to ensure that we're meeting that target. So there would be that's a relatively small debt issuance in the forecast would be required. I would note that at that point in time, our leverage is well below the 35% targeted level, and the district would have ample room to issue debt in the event that we were on a downside scenario, and we would still be able to maintain the 35% at that point in time. Similar to the quarterly updates that we give the board on the financial policies, we also include a what-if scenario to kind of put that into more specific terms. This particular case, and this is what we provided at year-end, we assumed a $20 flat market price going forward every year, as well as a 82% water outcome every year, as well as impacts to forecasted expenditures, increasing those forecasts up 10%. So taking all those three components, the associated what-if scenario in this case, again, uses up that cash faster, even faster than the unusual scenario that we are recommending. Actually, in that scenario, we're issuing about $60 million out in 2021. Again, the district has a lot of ability in the leverage ratio as far as much debt as we would have at that point in time, and had plenty of room to issue that debt and still meet those other financial target objectives. Feel free to jump in if you have any questions as I go through this. I'm going to kind of walk through each of the metrics, kind of identifying kind of the same application. Days cash on hand, this is just a subset of liquidity, focusing just on unrestricted. Again, the same mechanics are in place. Again, we would be issuing debt primarily to maintain liquidity, but this assumes the same amount of debt issuance under the scenarios that we're providing here. As you can see that the unusual case, which we would want to maintain the 250 threshold for the recommended policy, we would stay at the $350 million out in 2021. Again, I would note that would require about $18 million of debt issuance. And on the what-if scenario, again, we'd be well above the 350 at the 374, but again, that's associated with roughly $60 million of debt, again, in order to maintain the liquidity in that particular scenario. So overall, but with both cash metrics, we're strong through the five-year window. Out in 2021, under unusual cases, that point in time, potentially we would be triggered to look at potential action items, which in this scenario is applying a potential debt issuance. And again, I would note that that is the unusual scenario and not in the expected case. Looking at debt leverage, again, no changes in our current policy recommended here. Outside of continuing it on in the five-year window, moving that out each year. Again, the district is currently targeting getting below 35% in 2019. And as you can see on our base expected case, we're getting below that in 2018, down to 32%. And again, we continue to drive that down. The unusual case, yes. The unusual case at the 10% accumulated impact, gets us down to 23%, and that does include that $18 million of issuance that would be required to maintain liquidity. Otherwise, it would be at the 22% without the addition, well, 18 million. So that's a relatively small amount. You can see a relatively small impact to that debt leverage ratio. As Heather noted, it takes quite a bit to adjust that number down. The what-if scenario includes additional debt issuance to maintain liquidity, so it has that number a little higher at 26% out in the fifth year. Again, well below the 35% threshold that we are recommending per the financial policies. Above, you would see also the expected debt balances. Currently, starting at this year, was at $590 million. Again, dropping down to about $300 million. Again, that's under the expected scenario with the current debt reduction program. Looking at debt service coverage, again, this is an annual calculation of looking at what funds we have available to meet debt service, principal and interest payments. Under the expected case, we stay relatively strong, well above the 2.0 cover target that we have. Gets slightly below 3 on the under the expected case. One thing I would note on the current policy and the proposed policy is we have a lower threshold assuming unusual conditions. Again, that's more associated with our actual bond requirements. Bond requirement is maintain at least a 1.0. If we do not have a 1.0, we lose the ability to issue debt. So we target a 1.25 in the case of an unusual scenario where we have a downside in the wholesale market, maybe additional cost, other risks maybe come to fruition. Looking at our unusual case here, you can see even under that scenario, we're still well above the 2.0 in the unusual case. And even in our compounded what-if scenario, we only get down to a 2.0. So again, remain relatively strong in all scenarios on the cover. And we're not recommending any changes to this particular metric. The last metric, similar to cover, is just an annual calculation. This is looking at earnings for the particular year, bottom line results. And as you can see, we've included those expectations. In 2016, we were left roughly at $96 million bottom line results. Now that does erode over the five-year horizon, and it gets down to just under $50 million out in 2021, and that is the expected scenario. We have the rate of return expectations just shy of 9% this last year, and those do decline, only decline to about 5%. Our current targets are 4% under expected conditions. And again, as Heather noted, as we complete the aggressive debt reduction plan that's completed in this window, the requirement to have the additional rate of return metric and expected results are shifted, and so we're recommending that target sunsets and is no longer a continuation at that point in time. I would also note that cover, this annual metric does have a downside target. Again, we're targeting a 4% return under expected conditions. The district also looks at least maintaining a 2% return during downside scenarios. So that's kind of the general range that we're targeting. And looking at the unusual case, staying well above the 2% in both scenarios through that 2019 period. And I would also note that the associated bottom line related metrics are already established for water, wastewater, and fiber, and we'll be looking to establish a similar metric for the electric side as well this year. So I went through that pretty fast. Again, these results are tied to the results as of the end of January. Again, we'll back to the board each quarter going forward and give you updates associated with whatever policies are in place. Any questions on the financial forecast through that five-year window?
So when do you think you will be able to factor in the long-range facilities plan?
We can factor it in as soon as there's a decision on what action the board would like to take on that. Relatively, we keep the forecast model for the district updated on an ongoing basis. So as plans change, expenditures change, revenue forecasts change, market conditions change, related earnings, what have you. We incorporate those and formally report on those monthly, internally to management, and also quarterly to the board. So once there's a decision to implement some action plan, it would be incorporated. If there's also any decision related to designating or establishing, you know, separate cash funds, those would be incorporated as the board directed.
So where we are with the facilities plan is we're actually planning to bring it to you at the next meeting. We'll have a discussion there about what the big strategy is. And I think from there, there are two questions for the board. The first is, does the strategy seem right? And the second is, at what pace do we want to take this on? Because it's a big set of projects. And so in order for Mark and Heather to be able to deal with it, we'll have to make some decisions to help them be able to integrate the costs into different forecasts.
Steve, will we have some rough cost estimates so that then we can better inform us about pacing? Oh, yeah.
Yes, we will. So we will have we do have rough cost estimates that will be available to you at this at the March 20th meeting. Good. And I think my guess is we may even do a little iterative process here of thinking about if we were going to proceed with those actions, how fast can we go forward relative to hitting our financial metrics? So probably going to do a little back and forth there.
Mm-hmm. Sort of parallel, yeah. Thank you.
And which projection holds true.
Right, that's the hard part.
So the next slide is just a quick summary of the changes that we're proposing or the current metrics that we're proposing not to change. Again, debt leverage, debt service coverage, financial liquidity, recommendations not to change those, so they would remain unchanged. Rate of return would have the sunset out in past 2019, so we would continue that through 2019, and then it would no longer be a focus for the district going forward, at least at the combined district level. And then days cash on hand would just replace the current unrestricted cash target that's currently a subcomponent of liquidity, and we would call that out separately, and that would transition to a days cash on hand calculation versus a fixed dollar amount. So that's a quick overview of the district's combined recommended policies moving forward. So again, just a couple summary statements. Again, the district's finances are stabilizing as we move forward and we complete the debt reduction pay down in particular, and as we continue to pay for major capital investments through cash reserves. We do expect that strong, stable position to remain consistent. That could change with other decisions and other actions or other impacts from the market. But the unusual case, as you can see, we're well positioned to weather the storm, at least in that planning horizon. And these policies continue to support maintaining a AA credit bond rating. Again, our results are up, well above or better than our current peers. And again, we will continue to evolve those financial policies, continue to listen to customers, the board, and we'll continue to align those with operational conditions as they may change as well.
So, Mark, how significant is the difference between a AA and a AAA rating?
Well, it's going to probably depend on the market at the time. So the market's relatively depressed as far as issuance cost and, you know, interest rates. They'll probably have been shrunk. The margins have shrunk there. I would probably defer to Heather on the details from Treasury. But as if those were to increase, let's say, you could have wide margins in interest rates. So that's one of the primary things you look at is the ability to actually market those bonds and at what rates you'd be paying for those. So the district's positioned well in the event we did need to move forward with external financing. And there are other contractual terms that may be impacted as well for the district maintaining a high credit rating.
But how much, what type of things would we need to do different to be looking at a AAA?
Full faith and credit of the federal government. No, honestly, that's what it is. So TVA is a AAA.
Yes.
And the distinguishing factor is full faith and credit of the federal government.
That's so that you're saying it's impossible without the federal government.
Even BPA is not a AAA.
Yeah. Okay. It would be hard for us to be stronger financially, I would believe, at this point in time, to change that rating from a AA+.
AA+, right. That's what we're... Yeah. We'd like that AA+.
And there's only a handful of public utilities that are a AA plus, and we're one of them. So it's a very elite group, I think.
Here comes Kelly. This is Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Officer. My competitive spirit is kicking in, so I can't let this go unstated. So Moody's does rate us lower than the other two entities. So we have a AA plus, AA, and what would equate to, you know, a lower in that AA category. So there is room for us to improve overall in Moody's eyes. I would equate it pretty close to Steve's statement of nearing the impossible, but we're not going to give up on that challenge. But they have told us things like, in order for us to be considered for an upgrade, we would need to improve our debt coverage to a 3.0 times rather than a 2.0 times, as just an example of that. So I didn't want to leave the group without thinking that there are things that we are striving to improve overall to up our ratings with S&P and Moody's in particular. But those are, you can see the strength that we would need to go to. So those are very challenging goals, but we have them.
Thanks, Kelly. And I would add to that that it's a balance thing. So the more stronger you become financially, you have to take from other areas, either through maybe rate increases or other cutbacks. So it's a balancing. So these financial policies are intended to provide a strong financial stability as well as balance other district initiatives and objectives. So looking forward, we're completing that first phase, which is the Q1 target of getting these policies out to the board. As far as recommended policies at the district level, we will then take that and look to confirm and establish business line metrics. So the business lines being water, wastewater, fiber, as well as the what we call the integrated electric, which includes electric distribution, as well as the hydros transmission. Then once those are established, we would move working with the board to establish long-term rate guidance. As part of that, this would also include establishing any long-term internal or external debt guidelines, again, by the 1st of December is the current target. So those are the next steps. Any additional questions?
Thank you. Good.
So I'll just say, Mark just noted, we'll be bringing this back to you as a resolution in the next board meeting. Won't be planning to make a presentation unless you have questions for us between now and then, or if we get public comment of some kind.
Thank you. Legislative update.
Hello, Commissioners. Sean Seaman with External Affairs. We'll make this real quick as we are getting close to the next cutoff date, which is this week. This Wednesday will be for bills to get out of the House of Origin. So I anticipate that as a date where we'll see even fewer bills be watching, but stay tuned. So just going over the document you have in front of you, there was one update that I had made based on something that happened over the weekend. I'll get to that from what you reviewed on Friday. On the Centennial Grant funding, again, this is the funding for the Peshawestown Wastewater Project. We've provided some more information to Senator Hawkins. He's been very supportive in working with the Senate budget writers. We've met with House budget staff, and we are working on getting meetings with Senate budget staff this week as well when I'm back over there in the next couple days. The fuel mix disclosure, this is the long-running issue where we put information on our bills regarding the mix of our energy sources. It's been used and trying to be used for determining our carbon obligations in the past. So right now there has been no activity this year, but the Department of Commerce held a couple meetings, actually canceled the last one to try and work on issues. But Representative Morris has indicated he may want to work on this issue after we get through this next session, or the next cutoff sometime this session, though, and review the issues that the utilities have with this fuel mix disclosure. I'll talk about it briefly in a second on the carbon bills, but it is still being used potentially for determining carbon content of energy in at least one of the carbon tax bills. On distributed generation, distributed system planning, the only thing moving forward at this point, again, out of Representative Morris's committee, is now a solar bill. This is for the cost and recovery incentive. This is something that fairly recently came back out of his committee. He moved it forward after the initial cutoff. It's considered necessary to implement the budget, so he now has a new bill. He moved out March 1st, and this would just extend and redo the incentives for the solar, for those who have solar, in and particularly in on the grid right now. And for us, there should be a minimal impact. It would extend the program just another few years and changes the program quite a bit, reduces the incentives. And it's going to, it has a long ways to go through the Senate, but it is necessary to implement the budget, so we could see that through the end of the session. Number four, the state auditor's issues. The particular one that this is the one that did change over the weekend. This was, remember, 5036 was the bill for the unit price contracting. It was one that the PUD Association was promoting. It has now made it through the Senate and is into the House. So that's good news. It's moving forward.
Didn't it make it through unopposed?
It had no opposition. I'd have to look at the vote, but it had no opposition moving forward. Number five, Retail Telecom Authority. This is for us. It was a safe harbor, and the PUDs wanted Retail Authority. Neither one of the bills that were out there made it through, so those are dead for this session. Pole attachments, and this includes the small wireless cells. You've been hearing about this. It's been referred to as the 5G, but it's the whole idea of providing more authority or changing authorities to allow wireless cell companies or other companies to put more wireless transmitters around in the right ways. But for us, it would be a section which would change the whole pole attachment rate. So this bill, 5711, it's been going through quite a bit of conversation, discussion. There is back and forth right now. It's on the Senate floor. There are amendments that are being proposed that would include eliminating the pole attachment section. And another one that would could be a companion to that, though, would be to do a review of pole attachment rates across the state and see how those rates are impacting broadband deployment. So that one's going to happen. Something has to happen with that one by Wednesday, the cutoff at 5 o'clock. So we anticipate in the next couple of days to see some activity on that.
Sean, I need to share with you that we were in Washington, D.C. this last week and spent a lot of time with George Kahn.
Mm-hmm.
And he was constantly on his phone on this particular bill, working the issue for the association.
It was a pretty hot item last Friday. Numerous amendments on being pulled, put on the floor, being pulled. We have there is a strong group on this, including Dave Arbaugh. Spent a lot of time on this. We really appreciate him being on the ground working for us on this issue. The fire liability, the only issue here, that although there was no bill, this had to do with the PUDs in particular and reliability related to fires that may have been caused by trees that were outside of our ability to maintain out of our right-of-way. What's new to this one is that the Commissioner of Public Lands, Hilly Franz, is interested in talking about this issue, and she'll be at the PUD Commission, the meeting in April for the lunch. And so maybe she'll, hopefully she'll address that issue there.
It's a pretty complex issue, and I think it probably will be worthwhile for us to get you something in advance to make sure you get some good questions into her if she does show up there. Even if she doesn't address it, I think it's important enough that we to the PUDs, we want to make sure that we get the issue on the screen for her.
The HPA, which is a hydraulic project approval bill, this one it's still moving forward. They're trying to make some amendments to this one. Minimal impacts to the district would increase the cost of these hydraulic permits that we receive. And it did change. It took out the penalty, the $10,000 penalty, which is nice, but there's still some problems with the drafting of the bill we want to work on. I'm just going to jump down to the trust fund. There was some activity going on today, just some emails back and forth. The Senate has a version of the bill which is not being promoted by the Public Works Board. The Public Works Board is promoting the House version of an omnibus bill based on House Bill 1677. And so we're waiting to see what moves forward with the Senate version of a bill, which is completely different. They are not companions. The Senate bill would basically move funding over potentially to another group, the Housing Finance Commission, as opposed to the Public Works Board. Some other key issues real quick. The House Bill 1334 was the environmental communities bill related to post-2020 for the I-937, the Energy Independence Act. That didn't make it through the House of Origin or the committee, so that was no longer alive. Some HR bills, human resource-related bills, 1116. is implementing family medical leave insurance. Part of this, we believe, is related to the initiative last year, minimum wage. We are watching that one carefully. Lauren has been weighing in on some of her concerns on that bill. 5545 would make collective bargaining meetings open to the public. Again, we're working on trying to amend that or do what we can to protect our ability to continue meeting as we do. 5836, another one, just enforcement of the Equal Pay Act, and there's some minor aspects of that that we're working with Lorna to address. On electric vehicles, the original Seattle City Light and PUD legislation was to provide some more authorities, did not make it past the House of Origin, first cutoff, I should say. There's some efforts by some of the groups interested in promoting EVs to try and find a way to do something that would be tied to the budget, like some type of tax credit. Have not seen any language on that yet, so we may or may not see anything with electric vehicles moving forward in this session. Carbon bills, most, if not all, the carbon tax bills, are considered necessary to implement the budget. But there's also the first House Bill 1144, which would be to amend the greenhouse gas limits. That one is still alive. This would basically take the 2050 targets and increase those to a higher level. But the carbon tax bill that we have, 5127, next below that, is the governor's tax bill. It is still alive, as are the other two tax bills that were promoted, House Bill 1646 and another one by the Senate, 5385. These all are necessary to implement the budget, and they just haven't been worked on as aggressively as the House and the Senate trying to get through the policy bills. So we should see more activity of those as we move forward with the rest of the session. A couple of those bills, particularly the governor's bill, 5127, does have a tie back to the fuel mix disclosure, so that's why we're still paying attention to the fuel mix disclosure bill. One of the other bills has a connection to the fuel mix disclosure bill, but it doesn't rely on it. It just it has a mention of it and seeks that Commerce would work on how could they use that information to assign carbon to non-declared resources such as the hydro. So they both have connections to it. One is more of direct connection. One is do more work based on that information. Just finally, there was 5624. This is one that Senator Hasegawa is seeking more information on our bills. There's an effort right now to have that information provided for on our websites as opposed to having it on the bills. Bills get pretty busy as it is right now. The 5128, we've talked about this one last year. This is called the Capstone Bill. This would simply allow this particular biomass facility to get incremental energy credits for I-937 as we do with our hydro industry. The problem with this one is there was some drafting language. It's been fixed. The hydro industry is fine with the current amendment that's been adopted by the Senate and moving forward. So we're in good shape on that one now. And finally, a new one that you haven't heard about is House Bill 2087. It's one having to do with road worker safety. This is particularly being promoted by IBEW, but it puts our utility workers, amends language around road worker safety and road traffic laws such that they would have to treat our road workers with the same consideration as other emergency vehicles such as police, fire, and others to provide and move over as they do with other emergency vehicles. Very simple language, just amends a couple sections, but it moved out of the House with a 96-0 vote. So this looks like it's a good one for road worker safety. And if there's no questions, or there are any questions, I should say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good update. Okay. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda before us that now includes resolution number 10. What is the desire of the commission?
Chairman, I move that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
I moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda amended to include resolution number 10. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. The next item is manager items, but I do notice that Lisa came in to talk about commission travel, and so to facilitate your time, if you want to do that now, that'd be great. You bet.
Thanks, Lisa. That's the first nice thing you've said to me. I know. I also got that heart.
Okay. No, but I've got new commissioners.
Updated?
Oh, you did this
Tuesday.
This is the updated one. Oops.
I think
you can send them our way too.
This is
no,
they're different.
Oh,
Wednesday. I think maybe.
Nope, they're all.
Okay, good enough. Good enough. Okay. Yeah.
No, they came from this way, and I was thinking you already had one.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Very good.
I was thought you came in with your own papers.
Not in this room.
I thought it was super efficient. I'm Lisa Sanders, admin and finance backup clerk of the board. And I'm here today to go over your travel. I've also handed out the NWPPA, the agenda I found online. I haven't found a registration form yet, but I will get that to you as soon as I find it. And Commissioner Smith, you're not attending? Is that right?
This next week, we will know Tuesday night. I have jury duty, and I have to wait till the last minute. I might know before then if I get on a jury this week. That's March. April, I'm not attending. I'm not. Yeah.
Sorry, I started out too far.
Okay.
I confused this. So we have Commissioner Congdon traveling to Missoula, March 8 through 10. Is that all taken care of?
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Waputa in Olympia, March 15 through 17. I handed out registration forms for you today. Please double check your hotel requirements so that I can make sure those are all updated, exactly what you need. We have Waputa in April.
And that's the one I will not be attending.
Oh, for sure. Okay.
Right.
Do I need to cancel everything for Commissioner Bowles through May?
Not yet. Nope.
Through April.
Through April. Okay. Okay. So I've put April 14th on. This is a individual item just because it's our last day to cancel rooms at Sun River without a penalty. So we've already paid a one-night fee for each reservation. So that's an important date for us to watch for. So we have NWPPA and Sun River May 7 through 10.
I will not be at that one either.
Okay, so that. And Commissioner Bowles, I'll cancel his.
You said through April, so that one. You...
Oh, May. That's May.
June. That's May.
May. Okay, yep, I'll wait. Thank you.
No, Lisa, it says fly into Bend, but I actually looked at the flight information, and you actually fly into Redmond. It's kind of called Redmond/Bend Airport. Redmond's about maybe 9 miles north of Bend.
Okay.
So if somebody tries to make a reservation, you know, you're going into Bend. I mean, you're going to Redmond.
Okay. Thank you. I'll update that. We have the APPA annual meeting June 16 to 21. Commissioner Congdon is not attending, correct?
No.
Okay. June 29 is the Waputo Water Committee. Are you going to that?
Yes.
Okay. Then we have APPA. In July for Commissioner Smith. Are you the only one attending?
Right.
Okay. And I show that you're going to book your own flight.
Correct.
Okay. July 19 to 21, Waputo and Ocean Shores. I don't think I've seen anything on where that's taking place or what hotel they've held. Have any of you?
Not many places there, so.
Oh, there aren't?
I can't. No,
not in Ocean Shores.
So I can't just remember find the name a place? Of
the one. Well, no, they'll have a place. They'll, so you just
okay, have, so you, we, haven't
we haven't heard.
Seen anything yet. Okay. I think I missed April 26th, Commissioner Smith, for Energy Northwest.
Right. Got it on my calendar.
Okay. And then July 26th as well, but maybe... Commissioner Bowles will be back. Yeah. September Waputo at Douglas PUD.
And I will not be here.
Okay, thank you. October Waputo individual committees.
We'll let you know.
I won't be attending.
When is that? October. Yeah, those are committees generally. You have to be appointed by somebody in the chair, so we'll know at a later date whether to put you in on that.
Okay, perfect. October 26th, another Energy Northwest. November.
That's one, just for your information, that all commissioners get invited to. It's the Energy Northwest, sort of their annual meeting, and they invite all commissioners to it, so...
Called a forum. They call it their forum.
The forum, yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'll update that. We have rooms held in Olympia in November for Waputo meetings. And Waputo Annual Conference. In Spokane in December. It looks like another water committee meeting in December at some point for Commissioner Congdon.
Quick question on the July APPA meeting. Okay, you do have a hotel booked for me. I see it there.
Yeah.
Got it.
Good. Okay. Did I miss anything? Are there changes that I should be making?
Looks good.
Yep. Any way to make this more helpful?
Oh, yeah, it's.
This is good.
It is good. Thank you. It's very good. Yeah. Right.
Oh, I'll take that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lisa. Oh, yeah. Here's mine, too.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Manager, right?
I got two things. I want to start with John Stoles to give us an update on the outreach that we're planning for automated metering infrastructure. Recall that we're trying to get to a point where we can make a decision on that by the end of April. So we've got a lot of work to do over the course of the next 60 days.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utility. Since we last met late February and we approved the board approved the UtilaWorks, we've been actively kind of working the community, setting up meetings. I'd like to be more definitive on dates, but we're still in process, but I can give you kind of a rundown so you get a flavor for what we're doing. We have had the opportunity to pass out the flyer that kind of talks about the program in general at pretty high levels, some of the benefits, the business case, things of that nature. I've I've had the opportunity to personally deliver that to most of the mayors in the county, just so they're aware of it. Interesting, I think several of them identified there may be opportunities when they look at their water metering, for example. There's opportunities to partner. So kind of the consensus from that group is, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. We had a key accounts luncheon last week. This was one of the topics. Andrew Wendell did a nice job speaking to it. Again, a lot of support out of that group. Of course, you know, they see a lot of benefits from enhanced outage management, things of that nature. Suzanne's been pretty active, kind of out there trying to, you know, again, look up some forums and some venues. So just kind of the things we plan on doing. Chelan, I think the chamber has agreed to kind of let us use the building, maybe even be involved to some degree. So a couple of meetings up there, a bicultural bilingual meeting in Chelan, possibly Wenatchee. We plan on doing community meetings within each municipality. Those would be the more formal PUD sponsored, probably bringing UtilaWorks to do some support for those. But then we'll do lots of ad hoc meetings where we can, occasional service club meetings. I've been invited to speak to the city council at INEANT in April, so things of that nature. Lake Wenatchee, we plan, George Wilson's agreed to kind of help get the word out to see if there's any feedback. We may do a meeting up there if there's interest. We've talked to Graham Watson, who kind of represents the Plain area significantly, and he's agreed to support. He actually has a nice little meeting room up there at his hotel complex, and he's agreed to let us use that. So the word's getting out, but there will be a lot more coming when we do have dates that we can identify and then just let you know when they're scheduled and planned for. But generally, I think really good feedback. People see that makes a lot of sense, so there's a lot of support to keep moving forward. Suzanne, did I cover everything from your perspective? So we'll continue to update the website, our materials, again, as we move forward and anticipate coming back in April.
Super.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd ask John to stay and do one more item in case there are any follow-up questions on this. We did get word, as did lots of people across the county last week, that the Washington State Department of Transportation got bids on the Noceum Road roundabout that exceeded the budget that they had available. And so they called to tell us about that. Senator Hawkins has called to provide us an opportunity to have input on where do we go from here. So just by way of background, they had approached us last year. They wanted us to move utility facilities in order to facilitate the construction of the roundabout. We really don't have a choice in, when they make that friendly request. And so we took action and moved other work in order to be able to accomplish this work over the course of this past winter. And, you know, we had folks out there working in pretty tough conditions in order to make that happen. We basically are done. We're in the very last few days of concluding the work on that, roughly $400,000 worth of work for which we do not get reimbursement, by the way. This came up. So the conversation with Senator Hawkins, I told him that he was asking the question, does the PUD have a perspective with respect to how those dollars should be allocated going forward? Is there are different transportation options. Some people in the county are recommending that the money be spent in a different place. I told him that we did not have a perspective on that as far as I knew, although I would check in with you. There was nothing that where the PUD felt like there was a transportation constraint in the county that was impeding our ability to carry out our activities. And so said, don't really have a view on that, a little disappointed about where we are in this process and that there's other work we could have done and we've incurred a cost. One could look at it as at least phase one is done or whatever decision might be made in the future with respect to Noceum Road. That would be the optimistic way to look at it. So we will choose to look at it that way. Other than that, we told them that they should look to others in the county as to where the priority should be for the spending of transportation infrastructure dollars. So,
from a Cashmere perspective, the Goodwin Street Bridge Fund would really be good.
I heard that at coffee this morning.
I suspected we might hear that from a Cashmere perspective. And, if there's something though different from a PUD perspective,
oh, okay.
Communicate it back.
So, Steve, maybe I just would add just for the recording that we do have that small agreement with WatchDOT for the relocation we did in our easement area.
Right. So there's a $35,000 commitment that they do have a contractual responsibility to pay us for, and so we do anticipate getting payment for that.
So how many dollars are wrapped up in this roundabout that they didn't have enough money to pay for?
We estimate a little over $400,000.
But I think the overall project has incurred other WishDOT funds because they've been actively doing project management, outreach, things of that nature. So I think they're, and as Steve has mentioned, we worked pretty hard to meet their deadline, I believe, beginning of March. So we were out of their way to begin the project.
And I had, at coffee this morning, I heard the total dollar project cost was over $1 million, and that the shortfall was somewhere around $250,000.
Yeah, I think the numbers that we saw was the project was budgeted at something like 4.8 and came in at 5.2.
Yeah, and only $250,000 short.
So there is a current litigation, a foreclosure petition that the state's filed that we're involved in and monitoring as well associated with this. So. None of those dollars have been determined yet in terms of what the values of the property rights are being taken.
So the total project is $4.8 million?
I think it was originally budgeted at that.
Okay. Yeah. Now that's enough to finish the bridge.
So was that Brad's suggestion that he take that back to DOT, or did DOT ask that question of us?
It was Brad. He's just, actually, to his credit, he was just doing outreach to people across the community and saying, seems like you might have some interest here, just want to know what your thinking is about how to handle this, or how he should handle it, what recommendations he should make in the future. Okay. That's it for manager items. Okay.
Thank you. Commission items. Certainly, you've got some observations from last week, Commissioner McKenna.
Yeah, it was my first time as a PUD commissioner to go back to Washington, D.C., and I had a startling revelation that utility folks get the ear of their legislators versus education folks who go back and have their hands out. So instead of 5 minutes, meet and greet, take your photo in the hallway, we actually sat down with congressional leaders, had great conversations, and I was really, really impressed by the state coordination, the federal coordination, the talking points, the preparation. Very impressed with that, but also equally or more impressed with the knowledge of our key congressional folks and their ability to sit and talk with us. And I just was amazed by that. So something I'm not used to that. So that was surprising, pleasantly surprising.
All right.
Good trip.
It was. Any other commissioner items? I guess I would second what Commissioner McKenna says. Only to say sometimes it's better to be lucky than to be good. And I shared this with several people that did have a meeting with an aide to Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Didn't want to get the name wrong. Pramila Jayapal, who replaced Jim McDermott. And her aide, we went through PUD 101, which was really a very good conversation, and him indicating that she recognized that she had misspoken in her campaign about removal of the Snake River dams, and that she's backing up on that, which was, I think that was very, very open on their part. At the end of the conversation, came to the realization that this aide was a friend of my sister's. And his relationship, and this is the being lucky part, I think he's going to try to put together a trip over here to visit our facilities with staff and possibly the congresswoman. So maybe we'll have a relationship. So that was fun. Any other commission items? Follow up on delegation?
I've got two. One, we want to get some information to you in advance of the April WAPUTA meeting on fire liability issues. So that will be a month out. We won't report on that March 20th, probably the first meeting in April, to talk about it with you there. And then second, I know we have a lot of follow-up to do on the Chelan substation issue. So I heard a couple things, that desire to make a decision in a timely way, also desire to consider this LID option. So we've just got a lot of work to do there, and I know that we'll be needing to come back to you certainly at the next meeting and try to better understand what the will of the commission is.
Yeah, I hope we have a discussion about your second point about the possibility of doing an LID before staff digs in and does a lot of work on that. I'd like to have some more discussion surrounding that.
Okay.
Because there are a lot of difficulties with that. I see.
Okay. We will get with you quickly.
Okay. And so you just covered delegation then?
I did. Oh, actually, you know what? I did it out of order. I'm sorry. This because last time we only had one item, which was the LED lighting in the PUD parks, and you should have received an email from us about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any additional public comment? I don't think we have any public left. Any other matters that need to come before us? We don't have a need to set any special meetings at this time.
Not based on today's conversation or anything that I see coming up.
Okay. But we do have need of an executive session for approximately how long?
That is a good question. I'm going to say 90 minutes.
So we have need of an executive session for 90 minutes to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and we will go into executive session in approximately 5 minutes after we take a short break. Come back at 4, out at 4 o'clock.